has struck across the south. Hezbollah apparently still firing back as well, remaining intact. Civilians, as ever in the Middle East, caught in the crossfire. Israel says that it's self-defense after October the 7th. Of course, that case matters. But self-defense always has limits, because if your actions entrench Hezbollah, as they seem to have done over the last 20 years, destabilize any prospect of peace, then you are the impediment to peace. It's a very simple question this morning. What is Israel's strategy here? Because right now, it doesn't look like security. It looks like escalation without an endgame.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, President Trump has accused Iran of breaching a fragile ceasefire by restricting oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz. He's warned Tehran against charging transit fees ahead of planned peace talks in Pakistan tomorrow. Iran's supreme leader has said that management of the strait is entering a new phase without giving more details. Speaking last night, the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said that she's working to prioritise Britain's national interests.
Today we know more than ever that freedom of navigation is the underpinning of global trade. And it matters for every sea, every ocean, every strait. Every country has a stake in this. Every industry is affected by it.
The US First Lady has caused confusion with a surprise statement denying that she'd ever had a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. It's unclear whether President Trump knew that she was planning the address at the White House. Melania Trump also called for survivors of Jeffrey Epstein to be offered congressional hearings to share their stories. One of Epstein's survivors, Lisa Phillips, hopes that Mrs. Trump acts further.
Why would you make a statement like that and then not do anything? Mm-hmm. I'm just always like an optimist, first of all, but also, like, what are you going to do if you want to see justice or accountability? And so do all the survivors and the American people. What's the next step there?
Russia has announced a ceasefire in Ukraine for Orthodox Easter this weekend. It'll come into effect tomorrow afternoon and last 32 hours. British holidaymakers are being warned to be aware of additional checks with the EU's new entry-exit system. It's due to be fully implemented at all European airports and ports from today. It'll see the stamping of passports scrapped in favour of visitors registering their biometric details instead. The system's been brought in to strengthen border security and to improve processing speeds at airports. And NASA says there'll be anxious moments as the Artemis II crew re-enters Earth's atmosphere at speeds of around 25,000 miles per hour. Officials say they have full confidence, though, in the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft. It'll splash down off the coast of California in the early hours of Saturday morning UK time. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 24 points at 10,624. The pound bought $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather turning increasingly cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK through Friday. Rain will move in from the west by the late afternoon, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
You know what you're getting with a bank holiday weekend? Traffic. Drizzle. Service station snacks. The sea.
Look, the sea!
Pebbly beach. Aggressive seagulls. Drinks at a local cafe / nightclub. A late night takeaway.
Chili, garlic.
Sometimes in life you just know what you're getting, like a luxury bed and a great night's sleep. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:03. Listening to Lewis Goodall here for James O'Brien here on LBC final day this week. And we're just going to start, get straight into it. What is Israel up to? What is Israel up to? What is its strategy? What is its end game? Because we have reached the end of a week where briefly, fleetingly, we seem to get vanishingly close to at least a cessation of the fighting and some modicum of stability in Iran on the Straits of Hormuz, unlocking some economic relief for a world which is hurtling towards recession in a way that I think most people, including even politicians in this country, haven't fully woken up to yet, but also, most crucially of all, some relief for innocent civilians in the region. And yet here we are on Friday with even a temporary ceasefire apparently as illusory as an out of reach as ever, largely because, and we can discuss whether this is justified or not, Israel appears to be blocking it. In the last 24 hours, the Lebanon ceasefire, which according to the Iranians has proved itself to be the impediment to the ceasefire coming into effect, the Lebanon part of this conflict has looked less like a deal and more like a illusion. In fact, what we're seeing in Lebanon isn't just an escalation, it is something close to societal collapse in the south of the country. Israeli strikes have killed, depending on the count, well over 250 in a single wave, possibly more than 300, with more than 1,000 injured. It's the heaviest bombardment we've seen in the war so far. Hospitals overwhelmed, supplies running out, more than 1 million people, 8 million people, a city the size of Birmingham, and what, I think roughly a sixth or so, maybe a little bit less, of the country's overall population displaced. And of course, this has had consequences, and the consequences are that Iran has continued to close the Hormuz Strait. Donald Trump has criticized Iran's handling of that in a series of Truth Social posts. He says that Iran is doing a very poor job of managing the waterway, where, of course, we remind you, 20% of the world's oil passes, and has warned Tehran against charging fees for tankers going through, coming, as I say, as fighting continues between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, with strikes reported overnight. And of course, those strikes are not just in one direction. Hezbollah is battering northern Israel as well. This is all coming ahead of what are supposed to be scheduled peace talks in Pakistan over the weekend, due to be attended by US Vice President J.D. Vance. But so far, we understand there is no sign of the Iranian delegation, despite the fact that they had tweeted that they were going to be turning up there, I think, today. No sign of them yet. And indeed, no sign from the Pakistanis that they're due to arrive anytime today, because that tweet, in fact, was deleted. So we have a situation where there is nothing but chaos in southern Lebanon. And the question, of course, has to be for us, why? Why is Israel choosing to press ahead just at the moment that the two primary combatants in this war, US and Iran, were willing to step away from the brink, however so briefly? Because Israel, in this case, is not even continuing at the pace it was at in terms of what they were doing in Lebanon during the war, but they are doing more. They're going further. They're pressing faster, and they're displacing more people and killing more people as well. Some of whom, doubtless, terrible Hezbollah combatants who are awful people who have done awful things, but doubtless also many dozens and scores and perhaps hundreds of civilians as well. So I ask again, 0345 6060 973, what is it that they're doing and why are they doing it? What is the strategy? Yesterday, and I think this is very revealing and interesting, just I think worth playing again in case you missed it yesterday, heaven forfend, I spoke to the freelance reporter in Jerusalem, Noga Tonopolsky. She laid the blame at this firmly at Benjamin Netanyahu's door, but not just Benjamin Netanyahu. The pressure that he's under, and this is something I think we don't understand and appreciate enough, the pressure that he comes under internally from his own coalition, which, remember, contains, and I use this word entirely advisedly, far-right radical elements.
The elephant in your conversation with Mr. Gandler, of course, is Mr. Netanyahu's political predicament. In other words, it may be the right decision for Israel, including in its position as an ally to the United States, to accept a two-week ceasefire also with Lebanon. It makes a lot of sense. But politically, Netanyahu cannot do it. Netanyahu promised safety for the north, and as long as Hezbollah is operating in the south, even if it's not bombing Israel, which today it is, it's bombing nonstop. But even if Hezbollah is not bombing Israel, if it's just gathering its forces, if it's building up its weapons stocks, if it's terrorizing residents of villages in the south, he has not fulfilled a promise that is a political kryptonite for him. And so Netanyahu can't, he doesn't have the wherewithal to tell Israelis, we're accepting this two-week ceasefire. We know this is upheaval in your life. We know many of you can't even live at home. Your kids haven't been in school. But this is an important wager for us. He can't do that. And so all he can tell Israelis is war and war and more war. Despite the fact, as you well said, Lewis, that almost three decades of war have brought Israel very little peace on the north.
Noga Tomopolsky, Israeli-based journalist there, talking to me yesterday, I think identifying a crucial component of this, which is that even if Benjamin Netanyahu wanted to stop, however briefly, the far-right elements of his own coalition would be unlikely to allow him to have the space to do that for terribly long. Let's just remind ourselves, though, of the slightly longer history of this. Because you can go back all the way, I mean, just even if you go back to 2006... and you have the Israel-Lebanon war, similar sort of thing. Hezbollah, yes, attacking Israel. Israel pounding back and doing it again and again and again in the name of destroying Hezbollah. Guess what? 20 years later, Hezbollah are still there. And they're still the security threat that Israel wanted to eradicate in 2006. Southern Lebanon was flattened then. Parts of northern Israel were under rocket fire. And at the end, no decisive victory. Just a fragile deterrence, which again has broken down. Since October 7th, of course, more security questions. Hezbollah firing rockets in solidarity with Hamas. Israel responds slowly but steadily. The conflict widens. And this is the problem that we've got to ask. What is the strategy? Because degrading Hezbollah is one thing, but what we're seeing now, strikes deep into Beirut, nowhere near the border, mass civilian casualties, a country already on its knees being pushed towards total collapse, that does not look like a route to peace or security, even for Israel. And you could argue, of course, that it looks like the opposite, because Hezbollah, just like Hamas, they thrive on this over the long term. They feed their politics, their toxic, evil politics feeds on destruction and the narrative of resistance. And every bomb that hits a civilian doesn't just destroy a building, it recruits the next generation. We all know that. And on some level, the Israelis and Netanyahu must know that as well. And yet they continue. And this is why I'm sort of looking to you in a way to try and give me some sense of what are they actually doing and why. Because on the face of it, none of it makes any sense, because they've been doing the same thing for 20 years and expecting a different result. And it never, ever seems to work. So why are they using this moment, a moment where we could have at least a brief pause, a moment, a breath of peace, to push on? And of course there is, and you know, one doesn't do to be too conspiratorial about these things, but it's not conspiratorial because it is coming out of the mouths of the Israeli government themselves. We heard, we saw what Bezalel Smotrich, the far-right Israeli finance minister, has said in the past few days, where he has wondered aloud and said aloud that actually perhaps the Israeli annexation of southern Lebanon would be a good thing. And of course, this comes at a time as well when there has been continued illegal settlement from the Israelis and from Israeli settlers into the West Bank. And so, of course, it feeds this suspicion, both internally within Israel, for whom there will be plenty of Israeli opponents of this, but also in the wider region, that this is part of a plan to extend Israel's borders and is an expansionist policy, and to use this as a moment of opportunity, that you have two things potentially alliding. This is one theory, that both Benjamin Netanyahu needs to stay out of prison, which means that you need to keep this war going for longer, just as he kept the Gaza war going for longer than he might have needed to, because he needs to stay out of prison and he needs to defer election. And then at the same time, you've got far-right elements that support him within his party and within his coalition, who want to use that moment of weakness and the lack of space that Netanyahu might have to end this at the right time, or the optimal time, because of his own legal problems, to achieve their maximalist radical agenda, which includes, among other things, continued illegal settlement and territorial expansion and smashing southern Lebanon to bits. And we've got to remember that Benjamin Netanyahu has wanted, in terms of not wanting this ceasefire, he's wanted this war for a long time. Just listen to John Kerry, former Secretary of State, of course, under the Obama administration. He was speaking to Jen Psaki, who used to be the Biden press secretary, on MS Now about his experiences with Benjamin Netanyahu and the difference between Trump and previous U.S. presidents.
You've probably sat across the table from Prime Minister Netanyahu more than almost anyone else out there. And he and Israel are, of course, big factors here. There's been recent reporting, you probably saw in the New York Times, that Netanyahu was taken into the situation where he basically pitched Trump on attacking Iran. Were you ever part of any conversations like that? I know he's made that pitches to past administrations. Were you ever a part of that? And were you surprised that he was able to convince Trump to do this?
Well, I was part of any number of conversations with Prime Minister Netanyahu, conversations that took place in other countries.
Pitching the U.S. to strike Iran.
Yes, he wanted us to strike. He came to President Obama. He made a presentation to ask to strike. President Obama refused. President Biden refused. President Bush refused. The only president who has agreed to this, obviously, is President Trump.
That's John Kerry there, the former U.S. Secretary of State, talking about how long, we're talking over 10 years, 15 years, that Netanyahu had been pressing successive U.S. presidents for this war. And now it finally came because Trump acceded when Bush said no and Obama said no and Biden said no. We're talking about George W. Bush here. This was no wallflower. Certainly wasn't afraid of getting himself involved in the Middle East. But even George W. Bush said, I don't think so, Bibi. I don't think that's a good idea. So that's another way of looking at it, isn't it? That this is a moment, a singular moment of opportunity that Netanyahu has been arguing for and pressing for and agitating for 20 years in office under successive US presidents. And it is an opportunity that will not and cannot come again. So in a way, why would you stop? Why would you stop? Should say, and I repeat again, Hezbollah, a terrible, evil, horrendous force, a security threat. They need to be dealt with. My point is that Israel have been trying this, and this is the maximal version of their strategy for 20 years plus, and it hasn't worked. So what is the strategy here? What are they up to? 0345-6060-973. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien here on LBC. The time is 10:16.
LBC.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2027 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only. At all protected.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies in limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine. Or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2027 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only. At all protected.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Few of your texts here. Asmar says, why are we scratching our heads about Israel's intentions when they made it abundantly clear over the last 3 years? Greater Israel are operating without immunity, committing more crime, war crimes than we can list. Why are they allowed to do this? We should, of course, always say, Asmar, as well, the opponents of Israel also commit war crimes all the time, which perhaps anybody with a balanced view of this ought to recognise. Hamas commit war crimes as they did on October the 7th. Hezbollah repeatedly commit war crimes. I have every sympathy with Israel needing to do something about Hezbollah to guarantee its security. My contention simply is if this is their strategy, they're going to make that problem worse, not better. Good morning, Lewis. Israel is attacking the Hezbollah terror organisation and by doing so, helping Lebanon get rid of itself from Iranian-funded terror group and achieving peace with Israel. Now, how can that be the case? How is it helping Lebanon to displace a million of its own citizens and attack Beirut, the government? This is something else that doesn't make sense about this argument. Guess who benefits? Guess who benefits if Israel destabilizes the Lebanese government, which they're doing by causing the massive displacement of people and attacking Beirut itself? Hezbollah, because they are an alternative government. They are basically a sort of shadow government, certainly for southern Lebanon. I've been there, I've reported from there. They are the government there, and they are just lying in wait, no friend of the Lebanese government, waiting to take more and more power, which they will do if Israel destabilizes the Lebanese government, which they are guaranteed to do by their current actions. Netanyahu right now says he wants talks with the Lebanese government. Well, have them. Have them. But they're not going to be there much longer if you keep going the way you're going. Mike is in Marlow. Mike, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I personally think it's all about Netanyahu. He's involved his big buddy, you know, his big bully friends, and he's letting Trump take care of Iran while he goes and bombs Lebanon. I just think it's awful. I think you know, he's been gunning for this for a long time, without a doubt.
Oh, so you think it all ultimately comes that Netanyahu won't accede to any ceasefire, Mike? But where does that end?
Well, it doesn't, does it? This is the problem. I mean, all they're doing is stoking up fury and revenge for down the road. This is never going to settle, is it? They're not going to go, oh, okay, we'll all go home now. It doesn't happen like that, not with these guys. 20 years' time, they'll still be after whoever they feel is responsible.
Does it end, therefore? And to be honest, I sort of thought this would happen yesterday, so I've been proven wrong, really, but I thought that Trump would ring Netanyahu and pull the plug, as he sort of did in the end over Gaza. Do you remember when the ceasefire finally came in? It's a pretty shaky ceasefire, if we can call it that way, but shorthand, let's call it a ceasefire. Trump, in the end, pulled the plug in a way that Biden never quite seemed willing to do, and actually got a lot of praise for it, even from some unlikely quarters, Trump. So I thought yesterday he would wake up, see that his ceasefire, which he desperately wanted, and maybe this will still come, maybe it'll come today, desperately wanted, was imperiled, and he'd phone BB up and say, look, at the end of the day, we're the dog and you're the tail, and you've got to stop this now while we have the ceasefire talks on Saturday. Hasn't happened yet, but presumably that is the only way it does happen.
Well, I don't think Trump was ready for Iran's response.
No.
I don't think he really considered the Straits of Hormuz, about the shipping lanes, about, you know, 20% of the oil being held up. He wasn't ready for that. He didn't gauge that. Which just shows what a great strategist he really is. But the truth of the matter is, Netanyahu doesn't care about that. Netanyahu just wants his expansionist program to carry on, doesn't he?
And the thing is that, and I think this is what we also have got to understand, and I keep going back to the point that Noga Tonopolsky was making yesterday. I'm going to be speaking to another Israeli politics expert after 10:30 as well, Ayala Palievsky, who will doubtless be able to fill in the blanks even further. But, you know, it's not just Netanyahu, right? Because, believe it or not, I mean, we might think of Netanyahu as being, you know, an extreme figure. And, of course, by standards of Israeli prime ministers, he is an extreme figure. We're not talking about David Ben-Gurion or Golda Meir or Yitzhak Rabin, whoever it happens to be, sort of in terms of Israeli leaders. We're talking about, you know, extreme figure. But the guys behind him, the Smotrishes of this world and the Belazels of this world, they are way more extreme even than Netanyahu. And they're the ones, ultimately, given the nature of the numbers in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, they're pulling the strings.
Well, if we could find out what Mossad have got on Trump, I think we'd find some clear answers, but I don't think
I don't know if it's about that. I don't know about that. I think the fact is that, you know, the Israelis have got we talk about the special relationship in this country. I mean, it's certainly not very special at the moment. But the truth is, the relationship that is truly special in terms of US foreign policy is Israel. And it has been under successive Israeli prime ministers and successive US presidents. So I don't think we need to conclude that Trump's got something on, or the Mossad have got something on Trump. I think it's just, you know, the Israelis have got a very strong relationship and always have, for historical reasons, with the United States. Adam is in Beverly, where I think he's got a different view. Adam, good morning.
Hello, Lewis. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What's your view on this?
My view on this is, I think, I think Israel has more or less run out of patience because they have been kind of contending with Hezbollah for the last 20 years. They have, on numerous occasions within the last 20 years, have tried to negotiate and liaise with the Lebanese authorities to, in order for them to, in order for the Lebanese authorities to eradicate the evil within, which is Hezbollah. As these particular authorities have failed, I think Israel also offered to collaborate with these authorities in order to eradicate the evil within. Again, that has fallen by the wayside. So I think Israel has had enough. There's an evil presence at their doorstep, not too far away, within striking distance. And I think Israel has to take drastic action. And this is exactly what they're doing now. You can't have an evil presence at your doorstep whose agenda is to eradicate the state of Israel from the face of this earth. So I think they have, like I said, they have been trying to negotiate for the last 20 years.
But Adam, is most of the time the Israelis have refused to negotiate with Lebanon. I'm not saying the Lebanese government isn't in all this, by the way. They've generally been weak. But my contention is this. You're guaranteed to make the Lebanese government even weaker by bombing it to high heaven. And ultimately, unless you intend to just permanently flatten southern Lebanon, which some people are worried is the agenda, but if that's not what you're going to do, then you're going to need a Lebanese government in place to work with you to deal with this terrorist threat.
Yeah, but I understand. But this is what Israel has been trying to... this is what Israel has been trying to do for the last 20 years. They have been proposing to the Lebanese authorities. I know that, I think Hezbollah has a presence, an authoritarian presence in Lebanese, but Israel has been trying to propose to the Lebanese government to collaborate with them.
But I don't know if that's true, Adam, because I'm not saying that Israel's totally to blame for this because it takes two to tango, but they don't even they have no diplomatic relations. I mean, they're technically at war and have been for years. So, I mean, there have been some limited agreements between the two sides on a few different things, I think including a sort of maritime deal. But there haven't really been any talks because they don't have any diplomatic relations.
No, because I was in the impression that when Israel made it clear that they wanted, I think there has been communications between the Israeli and the Lebanese government, and I think the Lebanese government did make promises to the Israeli government that they would do everything they can to eradicate Hezbollah within their realms. They have made those promises, and they have failed, and they have been failing for the last 20 years.
But if you weaken that government, if your aim is to disarm Hezbollah long term, that means, because you can't, we all know, you're never ever going to be able to kill every Hezbollah fighter, because every Hezbollah fighter you kill, particularly in the way that they're doing it, they're creating two more, right? Because we've got to conclude, they're forcing a million people from their homes, they're killing hundreds of civilians. Well, you and I both know that is going to radicalise a whole generation of southern Lebanese, and you know who's going to say, welcome to the club, lads? It's Hezbollah, right? We all know that, right? So given that, you might be scoring a short-term victory for long-term costs. Maybe that's all Netanyahu cares about, I don't know. But ultimately, if you're going to get a long-term solution, you're going to have a Lebanese government that you can work with, and everything that the Israelis are doing right now is weakening the Lebanese government. And Hezbollah are going to go, fantastic, because we can move in, because we're already more powerful than them.
But this is what Israel has been trying to do. They have been proposing to the Lebanese government to work collaboration in order to eradicate the evil within. Now, if anybody's to blame in all this malarkey, it's the Lebanese government, because they haven't really, delivered on their promise, because they did promise Israel that they would eradicate the evil within, but they have failed numerous times. And Israel even proposed to them that they would collaborate in order, because my impression is that the Lebanese government or the Lebanese authorities don't really want Hezbollah within their realms.
No, they don't. No, but they're quite weak. So Hezbollah, to be honest, are stronger than them militarily, so they can't do much about it.
Okay, but if they're weak, Lewis, don't you think they should have they should have proposed to Israel, look, we're weak, you're in a much stronger position, let's just collaborate together in order to eradicate
evil. I think the problem is, I think, Adam, you're right. In an ideal world, I think that would be true. I think one of the problems is that the internal Lebanese politics makes that very difficult for, historic reasons. But I agree, obviously, that would be the optimal solution. Adam, grateful to you. Let's get the view from Israel itself, shall we? Neil is in Tel Aviv. You're a reserve in the military, I understand, Neil.
Yes, that's correct. I've just been listening to a lot of these conspiracy theories about this greater Israel project. as an Israeli myself, this is all news to us. We generally don't understand what this means. As history has told us, the only way Israel has had peace through our neighbours, for example, Egypt and Jordan, is when we had to give land back to them through a defence measure. So I don't know how we can be a greater Israel project when we're about the size of Wales. As a Jew, I don't even know what that means.
I suppose, Neil, just because obviously lots of listeners won't be conversant in this idea, and it is, like you say yourself, a lot of Israelis will be taken surprised by. I mean, this is the idea, right? I mean, the reason I think that it's obviously had some legs beyond just conspiracy theories is that, you know, senior members of the Israeli government have said that they believe in it. I mean, obviously, in particular, Bezalel Smotrich has said, you know, back, as far back as 2023, he didn't use the term Great Israel, but he gave a speech from a podium showing a map that included the West Bank and Jordan. That is widely depicted, recognised as a depiction of Greater Israel. In the same speech, he said there's no such thing as the Palestinian people, and he's endorsed ideas that Israel's borders should expand significantly. Indeed, in one account, that includes southern Lebanon. So this is it's coming from Israeli government ministers. It's not just at the fringe corners of the internet.
Yes, they're coming from, unfortunately, extremists.
Yes.
And in every society, even the British society, I'm sure we have a lot of racists that want to kick out all the immigrants.
Yeah, but I agree, Neil, but to be fair, this guy isn't just like on some forum. He's the equivalent of Rachel Reeves. He's the finance minister.
Well, because we're in the war right now, they don't have any real say on our war mechanisms. So in terms of what they say, it's empty words. Wow. It's not something that we actually want.
But there are illegal settlements going on. I'm the first one to say, and I think it's such an important point that needs to be hammered home again, that like the Netanyahu government is not Israel, that there's lots of, you know, it's a democracy, there are lots of different opinions. But it is true to say that this government, I don't think it's true that it's just empty words, because under this government, you know, we are seeing the practical effect of it. There's illegal settlement going on in the West Bank. We're seeing what's going on at the moment. So it's not just empty words, is it?
So, like, the legal settlement, again, it is a very grey area, because, unfortunately, there has been a lot of history where a lot of Jewish land has been in the West Bank. A lot of farmers, a lot of historical content has been in the West Bank. For example, Hebron is a huge historical landmark in Israel. So that is a very grey area.
If we're going to play that game, Neil, I mean, the Palestinians listening to this will be like, well, you know, historically it's Arab land. You know, like, I mean, you know, that's the whole point. That's the whole point of contestation, isn't it?
I mean, you know, that's why we do want a two-state solution, yeah. Because both parts, we have a historical significance in that land. And unfortunately, when you have one side that wants to completely eradicate the other side, how can you have peace when you have a group of people that completely wants to wipe us off the map? Yes, we're not perfect, but unfortunately, we are surrounded by wolves, and we have no other opportunities to defend ourselves. You've got the Iranian regime. You know, we said for 40 years, they're going to build a nuclear bomb. They're going to build a nuclear bomb. And everyone laughed at us. Everyone said we're conspiracy theories. And what happened in 2012? We had the Iran deal with the US. And the deal was a 3.6 enrichment. BB said, give them an inch, they're going to run a mile with it. And look what we found. We found 60%. This is not conspiracy theory. This is black and white. We found 60% of enrichment. You need 80% to build a nuclear bomb.
But BB has been warning about it for 20 years. I mean, BB, if we'd listened to Netanyahu, Iran would have had a nuclear weapon before the turn of the millennium.
No, we said they are going to get a nuclear bomb. We don't know when, but it's going to be close. And as soon as they had the Iranian deal, we said on the stage in 2020, they are going to build a nuclear bomb. And it's black and white. This is not subject. This is object.
But Netanyahu said that he'd obliterated them 9 months ago. I mean, this is the problem, Neil.
That was Trump.
Netanyahu also said that they had crippled, that there would be no Iranian nuclear weapon. And then nine months later, he turns around and says, no, we need this all-out war. And anyway, if that's the case, if it's all about the nuclear Iranian nuclear deal, then that's nothing to do with Lebanon, is it?
Yes, we're talking about Hezbollah or Lebanon?
Well, Hezbollah. Anyway, I've got to go to the news, Neil, but I just wanted to ask you a question before. You said you're a reservist in the military. If you were sent called up to go and serve in southern Lebanon, would you?
Yes, 100%, 110%.
And you don't have any qualms or worries about the massive civilian death toll that's taking place?
Well, but that is war for you. War is horrible. War is disgusting. What do you expect Israel just to not evacuate the civilians and let them stay there whilst Hezbollah hides between the civilians? I mean, what do you expect us to do? Do you think you expect us just to stand on our borders and put our hands in the air? No, we have to do an evacuation zone, just like what we did in Syria.
A million
just
people? I'd love to continue this conversation, Neil, and Tel Aviv, but I can't. I've got to go to the news, so apologies for that. But grateful for, you can hear the passion in your voice, for sure. We're going to be talking to Ayala Panievsky, as promised, who is a real expert in Israeli politics, to try and get more insight into exactly the dynamics of the coalition. A little bit late to the news, 10:34 with Dominic Ellis.
President Trump has accused Iran of violating their ceasefire agreement, calling its management of the Strait of Hormuz dishonourable. It's reported only a handful of ships have passed through the vital shipping lane since the truce took effect on Wednesday. The government's announced a new multi-million pound missile contract with a UK startup. The Defence Secretary John Healey says the weapons will be used to intercept drones and defend airspace in the Middle East. And survivors of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have accused Melania Trump of shifting the burden onto them. The US First Lady suggested they should testify under oath about their experiences during a surprise White House address last night. LBC weather turning increasingly cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK. Rain moving in from the west by the afternoon, a high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
There comes a time in your life when you need to make a change, to start a new chapter. It's time to consider a residential park home bungalow from Ecos Group. Castleview Court in Pevensey is a peaceful gated community for those aged over 45, set in a stunning location close to all local amenities. You can enjoy a stress-free move with up to 100% part exchange on your existing property with free site fees for your first year. Make that lifestyle change today and join us at our open weekend on the 25th and 26th of April at Castleview Court, Pevensey Bay, Pevensey. Or visit ecosgroup.co.uk. That's ecosgroup.co.uk.
It's hard to concentrate when you're worried about your health. It can feel like there's a wall between you and the rest of the world. Like you can't be fully present.
Hello, AXA Health. How can I help?
At AXA Health Insurance, we build our teams with people who care. So when you need us, we're here to support you. For cover that cares, search AXA Health Insurance. Pre-existing conditions are not covered.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar, Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot, Bears. Kids, put on your swimmers for Jungle Splash.
Yeah, let's go, Mum.
Right. Cannon Arena, Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Wave Runner 2, Magical Wood and Cafe.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The Sun Rays on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Tales.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 10:37. Want your thoughts on exactly what is the Israeli strategy here? And is there anything that can be done to dissuade or persuade Benjamin Netanyahu to actually sign up to a ceasefire in Lebanon? 0345 6060 973. Let's turn to Ayala Panievsky for her insight, Presidential Fellow at City St. George's University, author of The New Censorship as well. Ayala, thanks so much for joining us on the show this morning. Let's just start with that simple question. What do you think Netanyahu's strategy is here? Because a lot of the world is looking on this, thought that there would be at least a brief ceasefire this week, only to discover that the Israeli Prime Minister had other ideas.
Right. So I think there are two important points to note about Netanyahu's strategy when it comes to Lebanon, Iran and the rest of it. One is he is on trial. Today's Friday. By Monday, if there is no war, Netanyahu is supposed to be testifying in his own corruption trial in court, which has not been going on very well for him. He is very aware of it and very worried about it. So this is one thing, the legal situation Netanyahu is trapped in. And the second one is the political predicament that you and Noga talked about earlier this week, but also there is new data on it. So last night, there were new polls coming out in all the big TV channels in Israel. And according to all of them, Netanyahu's coalition is in a very dire state. So there are 70%, it's not percentages per se, because in Israeli politics it's slightly different, but there are 70 points to the anti-Netanyahu coalition and only 50 points to Netanyahu's coalition. Why is it more than 100? Because in the Israeli parliamentary system, we have 120 seats in parliament. But the main point is that Netanyahu is not, and his coalition are not popular in Israel currently. He knows it. And in the next couple of months, we should have seen general elections in Israel. So these numbers are very worrying for Netanyahu and his coalition. And both for legal reasons and for political reasons, it is more convenient for this specific government to have war than peace right now.
So it's in your view, Ale, it really is, on one level, as simple as that, that if the war were over, say, by Sunday, Netanyahu has to turn up in court on Monday. But if the war's not over on Monday, he doesn't need to.
Oh, yeah. And it's not just my view. All the journalists who have been following Netanyahu's career over the years and who have been showing up to his court to his trial in Tel Aviv and sometimes in Jerusalem are saying this is a very powerful motive for this person who wants to be to save his own skin, basically. We have another indication for it, which is that during this war, where Israelis and, of course, many others around this region were running to bomb shelters, people lost their lives, hurt, injured, etc., Netanyahu really insisted on talking to Trump about his own trial, right? We've seen Trump during this war, as the entire world is watching people killing each other, he is putting pressure on the Israeli president to pardon Netanyahu for his corruption trial. So we know for sure that this is a very high priority for the prime minister of Israel.
And we should say, shouldn't we, that we talk about Israel as if, you know, the Netanyahu government is synonymous with it, but Israel is a democracy, it's a pluralist country, it has lots of different shades of opinion. And even, I think we're sort of, the view that we have is that Netanyahu is sort of the Israeli tail wagging the American dog. But as we saw this week, from political reaction in Israel, I'm thinking in particular of the opposition leader Yair Lapid, you know, criticizing in a television address, basically saying that Netanyahu had been completely outplayed, that he was in fact a lapdog of Trump, and saying there's never been such a political disaster in all of our country. Israel wasn't even part of the discussions when decisions were being made concerning our national security. So Netanyahu is actually getting criticized for being insufficiently independent from the Americans.
Oh, for sure. And actually, in Israel, the joke is that currently our prime minister is Donald Trump, because he's the one making the calls and we're totally dependent on him. And in the Israeli version of SNL, the kind of the satire...
Saturday Night Live, yeah.
Exactly. They have a Donald Trump figure, which is the actual real leader of Israel at the moment. By the way, Israel is probably the country where Donald Trump has the highest ratings
at
the moment. But... yeah. So yes, there is internal criticism of Netanyahu for kind of being led by Trump to do things that he shouldn't have done. But that's the situation on the ground.
But of course, that's Netanyahu's motivations. I mean, presumably there are other parts of his coalition. We should say that, you know, that we're talking about, you know, very radical figures. I mean, some far right figures. I mean, Smotrich is obviously the one that we talk about most, the finance minister. But do you think that there is any credibility to the idea? I mean, he's talked about it quite openly, this idea of annexing southern Israel and so on. Do you think that that is something that is actually a potential design and something that some of these figures actually think is realistic and that's what's behind this?
Yeah, I think it's super important to understand this coalition, this alliance between Netanyahu and his personal interest and the far right, as you mentioned. And actually, Bezalel Smotrich is not as... powerful in this context, although he is a minister and he has said all these statements. He's currently polling below the voting threshold in Israel. That's how little support.
So he'd lose his seat in the Knesset. So he would lose his seat in the Knesset. Wow.
If there were elections, right? Yeah. That's part of the problem. But Itamar Ben-Gvir is a much more, both more radical, but also more influential figure in Israeli politics right now. This is a person, a full-on Kahanist, racist political figure who used to be persona non grata, not just on the left or on the mainstream, but even on the right. People from the Likud party, from Netanyahu's party, used to leave the Knesset when people from people like Itamar Ben-Gvir were speaking in parliament. This is how far right he is. And he definitely has his own mission. And the reason, one of the reasons I think he's so important is that when friends of mine, people I know, were protesting this week in Tel Aviv against this war, the police forces were beating them up and forbidding them basically from protesting. And the minister who is in charge now of the police in Israel is Itamar Ben-Gvir. It's this very far-right radical figure. And this goes to say how difficult it has become to be a functioning opposition in Israel. And you see opposition leaders getting far less airtime than coalition figures. And you see protesters facing increasing violence when they are trying to express their views. So I think definitely understanding this, the different interests of the Smotriches and Ben-Gvirs and the Netanyahu loyalists is crucial to understand why things are working out the way they do.
Do you think elections will take place later this year?
I'm so concerned about this. I am not 100% sure. I think it will really depend on what happens with the war right now.
Is there a mechanism? Is there a mechanism to defer them?
Yes, of course. There is no date set yet, and it's up to the government to set a date. There should have been elections in 2026, but the second you have war, you have an emergency state. Mind you, for weeks now, there have not been schools, kindergartens, the economy. People are at home running to the shelters for 3 weeks now because of the sirens and hiding in bomb shelters, basically. So there is a way to say, oh, there is war. We can't do elections now. And I'm afraid this might be a convenient solution for large parts of Netanyahu's coalition at the moment, because, as you can see, they are not very popular.
And there must be such political exhaustion with war at this point now, Ayla, in terms of the median Israeli voter, because obviously, and this was, of course, forced upon them, October the 7th, the events were absolutely heinous and appalling. But one way or the other, Israel has been in a quasi-permanent state of war since that date, which is now, what, I mean, 3 years ago, going on for 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago.
People are exhausted. People don't understand why we went out for this specific war. They don't understand what we gained by it. I think it's pretty clear, if you're listening to the experts, both military experts and others, that Israel's position is worse now than it has been before this war broke. People are exhausted. They paid a lot with their kind of mental health, actual health. There are entire cities that people cannot live in now in the north, but also in other regions. So, yes, there is a lot of frustration. There is a lot of fatigue. But also, it should be said that people in Israel don't see everything that we see from this war. So even if we're talking now, as you did at the beginning of this show, about the casualties in Lebanon, this is not something that is really being discussed or mediated in the media in Israel.
No,
hardly at all. It wasn't at all in the Gaza war. It wasn't during this war in Lebanon. The immense toll, the casualties, the civilians, this is something that is not part of the conversation. And unfortunately, I think one of the most kind of significant successes of Netanyahu's government, not just this one, but for many years, is convincing Israelis that the only way to keep us safe is military force. And I think in many ways, even the critiques that you do hear of Netanyahu and his coalition right now are actually coming from the right in a way, saying, oh, why are you stopping this war before Hezbollah is abolished, like you said it would be? Why are you stopping the war in Gaza if Hamas is still there and you said you will eradicate them? So there is also this blindness to the casualties on the other side that I think is part of the story.
Ayala Paniewski there, presidential fellow at City St. George's University and author of The New Censorship. Really, real expert on Israeli politics, to whom it is always worth turning. You should definitely follow her on social media if you don't already. Ayala Paniewski, I want your views on exactly what can we conclude about Israel now? What is its strategy? And will they allow, for all of the reasons that Ayala was just outlining, Netanyahu, the politics of the coalition from both the right and the far right, who will turn to Netanyahu and say, well, no, even if you want to end it, we've got to press on. We might lose elections. We might have to have elections. You might end up in prison. Is there any way that Israel actually accedes to a ceasefire and therefore a wider peace deal anytime soon? Or will the whole world continue to basically, if we believe what Ayala says, the whole world will continue to be placed into economic turmoil and instability because Netanyahu wants to stay out of court? That is a mad thought when you really think about it. 10:49.
This is LBC.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
Hello, beautiful people! Get ready to rock with a new Volkswagen T-Roc. With £2,000 towards your finance deposit on the new Volkswagen T-Roc with Solutions PCP 7.9% APR representative. Test drive the T-Roc today and see why it won What Car's Best Small SUV Award. Order by the 4th of May 2026. Indemnities may be required. Volkswagen Financial Services.
Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrison's to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh buy of the day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26. Morrison's also sell other products. See online for more details.
Take Irish Ferries from Dover to Calais, where your pet travels in the pet lounge. You'd be barking not to. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
Ready for a new kitchen? Wix Kitchen Experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for Business. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:52. I think this point, we really need to sort of focus on it, about internal Israeli political opinion. If we want to actually really understand why it is that Netanyahu is pressing on, I think Ayala is absolutely right. Part of it is his legal situation. Part of it is sort of far-right opinion. But it's also true to say that I think there's pretty much unanimity across much of the political spectrum in Israel that the ceasefire, either from the left or the right, as it currently stands, is suboptimal for Israel. I was mentioning there, as we were talking about yesterday, the opposition leader Yair Lapid criticising the ceasefire because Netanyahu, in his view, who is just completely sidestepped by Trump and the Iranians, saying that it will take us years to repair the political and strategic damage that Netanyahu created due to arrogance, negligence and a lack of planning. Then you've got, sort of from the other side, you've got a guy called Fogel on the far right saying, Donald, you really wimped out criticising Trump, using the Hebrew word for duck to describe the American president, which in slang implies weakness or a lack of backbone. Yisrael Beitenu, chairman of Aviador Lieberman, warned that the ceasefire gives the Ayatollah's regime a breather and opportunity to regroup, adding that any agreement with Iran, without foregoing the destruction of Israel, uranium enrichment, production of ballistic missiles, and support for terrorist organizations in the region, mean we will have to return to another campaign. So they're already talking about the next campaign, under harsher conditions and pay a heavier price. There is a lot of agreement in Israel that the current ceasefire doesn't work for them. And that partly explains why, surely, Netanyahu is pressing ahead in southern Lebanon to prevent the ceasefire from coming into effect. Because one way or another, he's got a lot of political support at his back for doing so, even if they don't like the man himself. Jake is in Jerusalem. Jake, good morning or good afternoon where you are.
Good morning, Lewis. You're having this afternoon already. You know something? There's something very incongruent I've noticed with Iran's official stance, because for decades they've claimed that they don't support terror,
yes,
that they don't fund Hezbollah.
Well, that's a lie, of course.
And now suddenly they're jumping up and saying, hey, you're bombing us in Lebanon. What? Are you, so are they now admitting that Hezbollah's affiliated with them?
Yeah, well, it turns out the Iranians lie.
We can't trust the word they say, yeah.
Well, it turns out the Iranians lie, yeah.
They lie every time they speak, basically, yeah. So if if Iran says that South Lebanon was part of the ceasefire, and Trump says that it wasn't, I mean, Trump probably lied just a bit less than Iran. So, we don't know what the truth is, but Iran are probably in the wrong. That's safe to assume. Regarding the actual issue,
Two things can be true at once, can't they, Jay? It can be true to say that the Iranians... As we were discussing yesterday, it's also possible that it was, as Lord Ricketts was telling us, the deal was cobbled together so quickly that it's entirely possible that they both understood something to be true that wasn't. But also, it can also be true to say that Iran lies all the time, but it's also can be true to say that what Israel is currently doing in southern Lebanon isn't a very good idea.
The truth is, I don't see, and I've served in the Israeli army, I have a lot of friends who've done it too, and we all agree there's no way that Israel can withdraw military presence from south of the Litani River. I don't know if you're familiar with the geography there, but the Litani River is basically a natural barrier between Lebanon and the actual border strip of Lebanon that adjacent to Israel.
Yes.
Now, for the past decade, Hezbollah put their Redwan force, which consists of 50,000 armed men, right on the border. They crossed the river, and they had mobilized, they had howitzers, they had every...
We should just say that everything south of the Litani River, includes the city of Tyre, and of course that is all Lebanese sovereign territory.
What does Lebanese sovereign territory mean? The Lebanese parliament wants Hezbollah to disarm, and they're not.
Slow down.
Who's in control of Tyre? The Lebanese government.
No, but Jake, you ask what...
So who's in control of it? Hezbollah.
Yes.
So Israel's basically doing Lebanon a favour. They're going bombing the...
You think they're doing Lebanon a favour right now by displacing a million of their citizens?
The citizens are anyway conquered. The citizens anyway under control of the Lebanese government.
Jake, we spoke to a doctor yesterday, a British-Lebanese doctor. His family live in southern Lebanon. They're not conquered. One is a retired doctor himself and his wife. They were living perfectly peacefully, perfectly contentedly, and now they're on the verge of being displaced from their homes. Have been displaced before by Israeli military activity. I think you're a bit, with respect, you could argue you're being a little bit blasé about the fate of a million people.
Okay, I can't really discuss anecdotes, but we all know that Hezbollah has been killing Christians in... the Christian population in Lebanon has literally...
All right, Jake. Let's not discuss anecdote. Let's talk about the fact that the UN Refugee Agency has said that 600 children have been killed over the course of the last week as a result of Israeli action.
Is that the same UN Refugee Agency that changed the definition of famine to decide...
Are you really doubting that children have been killed as a result of Israeli action?
Why should I believe a word of the UN Refugee Agency, which for years were telling Israel to stop the blockade on Gaza, which, by the way, means stop doing security checks
and
on anything coming in Gaza,
and thousands of innocents died.
Letting in.
Jake, stop telling me to slow down because you're spreading lies on the national radio, right? So stop it.
I'm telling you now.
A million people, as we know, let's just discuss the facts here. A million people, according to multiple international, respected, multinational charities and agencies, have confirmed a million people have been displaced as a result of Israeli action. Now, you might say that that action is justified, but you cannot deny that that displacement has taken place.
Okay, you know, I mean, okay, if you believe them, Asim, I'm not going to convince you that what they're saying isn't true, yeah? I mean, besides the fact, I just want to say that these are the same agencies which for years told Israel, don't blockade Gaza. What does that mean, not blockading Gaza? That means that...
Well, it means maybe don't starve Gazans.
Hamas, that means that Hamas could bring in semi-trailers filled with Kalashnikovs.
It means don't starve Gazans. How about don't starve Gazans?
But, I mean, what are
innocent Gazans. Well, don't starve them. Don't starve them. Very simple. Don't starve them.
So no. But Lewis, not starving them also means in letting Kalashnikovs. So what would you do?
Well, there's no. First of all, there's no evidence for that because the various, including the UN, the UN Food Agency, the UN Food Agency is not going to allow Kalashnikovs into Gaza.
No, that's a stupid. How are they going to stop it?
Some people might say.
Anyway.
Well, the Israelis.
Oh, my God. Think about it. Think about this logically.
You are radicalised, my friend. Absolutely radicalised. You talk about death as if it's the easiest thing. You sort of like flash the magic wand.
That they die rather than I die.
Right.
Isn't that not logical?
No. It's about proportion, isn't it, Jake?
How is that not...
It's about proportion. You are supposed to represent. You fought in the army.
Slow down. Or my men are letting my 5-year-old niece die because it's disproportionate to protect her.
Well, so you're going to starve thousands of people. Starve thousands of people. You fought in the army. You fought in the army of a state that purports to be a democratic jewel in the Middle East. And yet you are sat here and you've said a million people, while they've been displaced or while they've been conquered anyway, never mind. And then you turn around to me and when I've put to you that the Israeli government have been part of an effort and have led to people either starving or being killed, thousands of civilians, 600 children in southern Lebanon, your response is what?
And you know what, Louis? I mean, you know, the first Gazan who comes up to me with a head of a Hamas member, I'd give him a hug. I'd give him a complimentary home in Jerusalem. Let's find one who
Okay, so your argument is that they won't be killed, and children won't be killed, as long as they bring me the beheaded head of a Hamas soldier. That's the price, is it?
If they deal with Hamas themselves, I'd be glad to leave them in peace. They've had 20 years, they haven't managed.
And so until they do, these civilians who, by your own admission, I would imagine, are being oppressed by Hamas, until such time as these old ladies and these kids rise up and get rid of this armed, horrendous insurgent group, your response is we have no moral responsibility towards those children.
I mean, I certainly have more of a responsibility to my own children than to theirs. I mean, that's just a basic... Whoever doesn't understand that doesn't understand the concept of, you know, a nation state.
Israel is supposed to behave better, isn't it, than the terrorist group that attack it and afflict it?
Could you give me, like, a definition of what better means? Better
Following international law, following international humanitarian law, not letting people starve, not killing kids, not just being disproportionate. Jake, you're asking me a question, and I'm going to give you an answer. So don't just then slow down. Let me give you the answer. Following international humanitarian law, not starving people, allowing humanitarian aid in, not cutting off energy and crucial supplies, and not acting disproportionately by forcing the displacement of 8 million people. As part of a war, by the way, where you have been rinsing and repeating the same tactics of bombing, say, Hezbollah to kingdom come. And guess what? It never works. You know why? Because you radicalise a whole new generation of kids to hate your government.
True, it doesn't work. Thank God.
In which case, why does Hezbollah still exist?
We haven't had a repeat of October 7 in the north because we bombed the heck out of them, and I hope they do.
You were fighting them in 2006, and you're still fighting them now.
And that's why it didn't happen in 2006. You see, for us, the only
they were attacking you in 2006.
Yeah, but they didn't do it on October 7 because we bombed them.
Well, they attacked you after October the 7th. They did.
Yeah, but thank God not that many of us died because they were scared of us, because they'd been degraded, and because we keep degrading them.
All right, Jake. We've had a spirited exchange, and you know what? I want the same things as you do. I want Israelis to sleep safe, Israeli kids to sleep safe in their bed at night. My worry is with the kind of radicalized view, which I'm afraid you haven't, and frankly, a completely dehumanized view with regard to other human life, that frankly, all that happens is that you are making sure that your kids, the generation that follows you, will end up not sleeping safely in their beds because the violence just creates more violence, which creates more violence, and dehumanized views of human life leads to other people having a dehumanized view of you. Time is 11:03.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, President Trump has accused Iran of violating their ceasefire agreement, calling its management of the Strait of Hormuz dishonourable. It's reported only a handful of ships have passed through the vital shipping lane since the ceasefire took effect on Tuesday. Peace talks are planned in Pakistan between Washington and Tehran tomorrow. Former British ambassador to Iran, Nicholas Hopton, has told LBC the conflict is entering a critical moment.
The big question is it possible to narrow the gap between the two positions of the United States and Iran, their interpretations of the ceasefire, which are both very different, and there are some real gaps between them, it seems. The Strait of Hormuz may not be one of them. The main problem at the moment seems to be the continued Israeli conflict with Lebanon.
Further Israeli strikes have been reported in Lebanon despite international calls for the country to be included in the truce. The attack came hours after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for talks with the Lebanese government over the conflict with the Iran-backed group Hezbollah. The UK government has announced a new multi-million pound missile contract with a UK startup. The Defence Secretary John Healey says the weapons will be used to intercept drones and defend airspace in the Middle East. A man who was convicted of killing his wife after she took her own life has been jailed for 8 years. Kimberly Bruce died in Dundee in 2023 after suffering 18 months of domestic abuse. Lee Milne, who's 40, was found guilty of culpable homicide at Glasgow High Court last month. Survivors of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have accused Melania Trump of shifting the burden onto them. The US First Lady suggested they should testify under oath about their experiences during a surprise address last night. It's unclear what prompted the speech, but Mrs. Trump moved to deny ever having a close relationship with Epstein. US political commentator Angie Wong has spoken to LBC and questioned the timing of the First Lady's address.
I think it is linked to the House committee having Pam Bondi on the stand next Tuesday. She's going to be testifying about the Epstein case. Maybe Melania Trump got a little bit of a preview. We're speculating, of course, and she wanted to get ahead of the story.
And British holidaymakers are being warned to be aware of extra checks when travelling to EU countries from today. Fingerprints and photos are replacing the stamping of passports as part of efforts to strengthen border security. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 40 points at 10,643. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather turning increasingly cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK through Friday. Rain will move in from the west by the late afternoon, a high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Sorry for the voice note. Just running for the taxi. Did anyone pack hair straighteners?
No, I didn't.
I've got hair straighteners. Everybody relax. Pre-departure drink, anyone?
Sure, you can roam in the EU at no extra cost, but what really matters is friends and family. That's why we're happy to be your second most important network. Tesco Mobile. It pays to be connected. Terms apply. See tescomobile.com/homefromhome.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Slow down. 11:07. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien on LBC. Look, I think that the sort of question, we're going to continue this conversation, I think, because I think that I think what we just heard from Jake there, and look, he clearly is very, very passionate about what he believes in, to the point of being zealous about what he believes in. And I'll say again, you know, from my point of view, I've always considered myself to be pretty, to have a nuanced view about so much of this stuff. There is no monopoly of good and evil in this conflict. And I know that will annoy lots of you by definition who want an absolutist view of the long history of the Middle East. But history doesn't work that way. And no side has a monopoly on morality. And there has been blood spilt on every side year after year, year after year. But I do think that if we're looking for an explanation as to why these wars don't end and why they're forever wars, I do think, just listening to the way that Jake in Tel Aviv was talking there, or Jerusalem, I think, was talking there, is very revealing and tells us much. Because the flippancy and the blasé way, the fashion, the language that he talks about death and destruction is a bit, as if and children, as if it's nobody, as if it doesn't really matter, as if it's they're not really fellow human beings, I think is very telling. And I think on every side in this conflict, I think what we have seen is a complete dehumanisation and degradation of the value of human life. And this hasn't happened overnight, but it is clear, and if you look at, and we heard it again from Ayala as well, the extent to which even within the Israeli media, there is very little focus on the humanitarian cost of the implications of the humanitarian cost of Israeli government policy. And as a result, there is, I think, a completely different media and information bubble going on within Israel compared to outside. And there is, particularly if we're thinking about the outside world versus Israel, there is complete incredulity on both sides. Israelis cannot understand how we cannot understand, or at least I'm talking about some Israelis at least, cannot understand how we cannot understand their plight. And the rest of the world increasingly feels as if the entire fate of the world and stability of the world is constantly driven by the actions of Israel, that many people believe increasingly acts like something of a rogue state, particularly with regards to its actions on international humanitarian law. You can get involved or you can get bogged down in the debate about genocide and the use of the word genocide with regards to Gaza all day long. I think far more fruitful to say something that is completely uncontroversial and ought to be completely uncontroversial, which is that Israel has repeatedly broken international humanitarian law and not cared much about it, and has certainly caused, without doubt, enormous humanitarian suffering of innocents and civilians. Now, they will say that that is because they themselves face enormous suffering as a result for innocent people, or as a result of the actions of Hamas and Hezbollah. And, of course, there is some justification to that, but on and on and on the cycle goes. And certainly I think it feels now, are we destined in the world? Are we powerless in this? Are we powerless in the West, in Britain, in Europe, in the United States? Are we powerless increasingly to determine our own fate and the stability of the world? Because ultimately Israel is in the driving seat. And Benjamin Netanyahu will not listen to anyone. Will he listen to anyone? 0345 60 60 973. Sarah is in Nottingham. Sarah, good morning.
Hi. Hello. Hi. So I'm British Iranian, and I've got a sort of a slightly different stance on it.
Please.
So you'd be surprised to know, I think, in the last hour, you were basically saying none of the presidents would have agreed to bomb Iran apart from Trump.
Yeah.
Well, I'm one of many millions of Iranians who are very happy that Trump is here. We think this is a great moment for us. I'm sure you're aware there's like thousands of that think this regime, the Islamic Republic regime, is a repressive dictatorship. And we think this is our only opportunity to get rid of it. So I think what's happening in Lebanon is, I mean, it's obviously it's a fact, but it's all linked to Hezbollah. The only way you're going to get rid of Hezbollah is to get rid of this Islamic regime that are just don't care and will just kill at no expense. I think you mentioned it it's going to be going on 20 years. It will go on and on and on and on. You might disagree with Trump going into Iran. I can see why. Obviously, we can see the disasters happening financially. But as far as we're concerned, we want this to finish. We want this regime gone. And I think it's only proven how terrible they are, what extent. There's no red line for them. They'll do anything. So I think this proves even more why Trump was right to get rid of these people. Well, obviously, he didn't completely get rid of them. But we think, you might be surprised, but there's millions of Iranians that don't want the bombing to stop. Obviously, we don't want infrastructure. We don't want civilian sites to be, you know, that stupid thing he came out with, getting rid of civilization, not to that extent. But we want targeted bombing very much like Israel's been doing. In fact, I wouldn't normally be a fan of Israel, but I'm one of those people that have completely taken a different view on Israel now. And we want them to carry on. We want any help to get rid of this regime, even if it means human lives, because we look at it in the long term. There is these people have been going on for 47 years. Iran is like the octopus, the head of the octopus, the terrorist octopus. So you know the Houthis have been weakened, Syria's been weakened, Hamas has been weakened, Hezbollah is one of the main ones that are staying. And they'll carry on because they've been funded by the Iranian regime, which was funded by Obama. I used to be a fan of Obama, but we all know the billions of pounds dollars that they gave to this regime.
It's not quite as simple as that, is it? I completely preface what I'm about to say by saying I share, and I've said since this conflict began, I share your complete abhorrence for the Iranian regime, the Ayatollah's regime. I wish it would fall. It has inflicted horrors upon its people time after time after time. It is no friend of the West. It is a sponsor of state-backed terrorism. On and on and on it goes. And so I can understand why there will have been Iranians who listen to what Donald Trump said when he said that help was on the way and cheered for it. But now we are, 43 days on from the start of the war. Can we not see that there is an argument as well to say that what Trump has done has strengthened the regime?
No,
they're still
absolutely
there.
Absolutely not. No, they're
well,
still
well,
there.
Well, let me give you an example. Well, let me give you an example in a way.
They've been strengthened. Let me give you an example. Do you know how many of their leaders have been killed?
And they've just been replaced.
Do you know how many people have been deflected?
And they've been replaced.
Yeah, they've been replaced, but they won't be as strong. They're not the same
Why?
People.
Well, actually, a lot of experts say that they're actually more hardline than the guys they replaced. And
they're
secondly,
not hardline, but there is deflection with them. They're obviously fighting within themselves. I've literally seen scenes of Iranian people. They've been on the street for 40, the Basij, you know, they're people on their side. They've been on the streets of Tehran for 40 days. Why are they on the streets? Because they're terrified. Because they know they're weak.
But
let me just finish one other point and then, why the fact that they've took, there was this, I saw an interview with the Iranian guard or whatever, leader, and he basically said, if we start striking the Strait of Hormuz, that's like the end. Like that's crossing the red line. When you cross the red line is when you know yourself you've reached the last. They're breaking all their bridges.
Sarah.
They're even hitting the Emirates, the Arab countries that we are friends. So even you might not admit it. They know themselves that they're on their last days.
Sarah, the bombing has been going on. I can understand why you want them to fall. But someone might say that you're engaging in wishful thinking. Because there has been 40 days of the most unbelievable battering of Iran, in which, as you'll know, many thousands of innocent Iranians will have been killed and caught up in that. Many more will have lost their homes, humanitarian costs, and so on. You might say that it's worth it. I mean, obviously, I can understand why you'd say that, but you're not there, and they are. And secondly, what is the Iranians going to do now as a result of this war? Because Trump has called it off. You know, Trump would like to end this war dearly. And let's be honest, is he that bothered about your Iranian family and Iranians, those in Iran? No, he's not especially bothered about that. And if he were bothered, then he would have, and if his aim was, as he said at the start, regime change, then he would have continued until it happened. But then the economic costs have got too great. And one way in which they are clearly strengthened is that they are now charging to go through the Strait of Hormuz. And that, something they never did before, and that is something that they are saying they want to do even after the war is over. So as a result, if the Americans accept that, and Trump has actually said he's happy with that as long as he gets some of the revenue, then every time you fill up at the pump or we fill up at the pump, we're going to be sending money to the IRGC. That's something that they never had before.
I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah, obviously.
No, it's not ridiculous. It's true. Yeah, it's true. That's what Trump said.
I know. I'm saying it's ridiculous for it to carry on long term. All these things you're saying proves my point that they can't stay the longer. But you're right. You can't get rid of a regime through bombing on air. The only way is to actually empower the Iranian people to overthrow this government.
But they haven't.
That's the only way. Yes, but they haven't, because like I said to you, there's people from, they've brought in their missionaries from Iraq. They bring their missionaries to slaughter the protesters from Iraq.
So what would we have to do to allow that to happen? What practically can we do to allow the Iranians to rise up in the way that you say that they will?
I'm hoping that behind the scenes they're actually helping, like in terms of arming some protesters. And then the other thing, what we saw Israel was already doing, but they've seemed to have reduced, is they were hitting, because in Iran it's full of like checkpoints where there's like besieged military, you know, to stop protesters, and they were hitting them. So what we were hoping, because Israel come down very low on their with their fire, you know, literally targeting armed the besieged. So what we want is once the protesters actually go on, you know, to actually have I'm hoping there's something happening behind the scenes, not on massive stakes, but actually boots on the ground to some extent.
Okay, Sarah in Nottingham, grateful to you. Sorry, just realised I was so so interesting what you had to say that I lost track of the time. So more of your calls on this to come, on this question of what is the Israeli endgame here? And is the truth that they are in the driving seat, not just of the Iran-US conflict, but right now, world stability overall. Times 11:18.
This is LBC.
Whether it's day one or you've been applying for jobs for months, one thing's for sure. You just need that one shot to show the world what you can do. If you don't know where to start, you've been dealing with rejections, or you could use a little help, get government support on our website. From tailoring your CV to matching skills with employers, JobHelp is full of little tips for every stage of your job hunt, because small changes can make all the difference. Get help with your job search. Search JobHelp today.
There it is, her suspicious face. She doesn't believe you. All you did was tell her your shirt was chenille. She said, "What's chenille?" You said, "Dunno, but you do know it feels chic." And so does she. She felt it for almost too long. Then you gave a twirl to show off the fit. She nearly spat out her croffin. You deliver the final bombshell. It's from Primark, only £14. Surprises served. Shockingly chic for £14. That's so Primark. Available in-store and on click and collect.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur, who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine, or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2027 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only. At all protected.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 11:20. We're asking this question as to what is the Israeli endgame here, and whether, until we reach it, whatever it is, basically they are in the driving seat, not only of the ceasefire, but of world politics and world stability overall. Sam is in Cambridge. Sam, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to you, Lewis. Thank you for taking my call. I think you're a very reasonable and fair person, so you're in the middle.
Well, that's a relief. Now I'm going to get all the texts telling me how unfair and unreasonable I am, but thank you, Sam.
And listen, I'm a pro-Palestinian, and that's my feeling. And as I was saying to your colleague, I'm a pro-Palestinian, and we as Palestinians, we've lost everything since 1948. However, for the past number of years, pro-Palestinians or moderate Palestinians have accepted that, look, Israel is there, Israel there to stay. We cannot help some fanatics like Hamas and others who will disagree, like in Israel, now you've got the right wing and whatever. However, the world needs to be strong, because you cannot get rid of fanatics by bombing. We've been bombing. I mean, what happened in Gaza, I don't want to go through it.
Yeah.
What's happening in Iran now? As you rightly said, Iran is stronger now than 40 days ago. If a regime has got to be changed, it's got to be changed from within. And the only reason the only way to get rid of it is by your rewarding the moderate people. Like from the Palestinian issues, you give them two-state solutions. So the moderate people will start saying to the fanatics, look what we got by peace. At the moment, they can't do anything. They've been moved out of Gaza, we've been moved out of everywhere else, and there is nothing to say that peace has gained them anything. Where fanatic people would say, well, because of this, we got this, we got this. You can bomb the Iranians. I've worked with Iranians for years. They're stubborn as anything. They won't see what's in front of them. They will keep fighting until whatever. You want to sort them out, it's got to be from within. You've got to cuddle and embrace the moderate people, reward them and give them hope for the future. But I just can't, as I said, I cannot understand how the Israeli mothers and grandmothers are happy to for their situation in Israel to continue. And I hear, like the other chap who was talking here, it's very easy for people sitting in London and in Europe, in comfortable, and they say, no, they must keep continuing bombing. They're not within the massacres there when they don't see.
I do. I agree with that. So, I mean, look, I can completely understand, and doubtless, if I were Iranian, particularly if I'd been, my family had been exiled or left the country, I massively dislike the regime. I wish it would fall. And obviously, if I felt like that, or if I were from that background, it would burn even more brightly inside me. But I think you're completely right. It is so often with all of these conflicts, got so many armchair generals just sat in comfortable homes talking about how important it is to rise up and do that and the other. And of course, revolutions do happen. And when they do, much good can come from them. Sometimes bad can come from them. But it's very easy for us to say, isn't it? It's very easy for us to say that this should happen or will happen when it's not our lives being put on the line.
It's very difficult. You've got to be within it to feel it. Mm. And it's like somebody loses their father. They say, oh, I feel sorry for you. You don't know how he feels because you're not in his place. And people who have been displaced in Lebanon as that Lebanese doctor or whatever, nobody can feel how he feels. They've been living there for years. He's a Christian. He's nothing to do with Muslims or Hamas or anything. He's been displaced like everyone else. So it's collective punishment to everyone.
There is, I think, Sam, there would be lots of people, I think about, you know, for example, some members of my own family who are sort of interested in politics but don't follow everything, particularly kind of world affairs, day in, day out. I think most people around the world, when they see just how much global politics is rocked by events in the Middle East on a very regular basis, they just cannot understand why it is that the cycle doesn't end. Could you very just simply say why you think it is that the cycle of violence never ends?
Greed. Greed, because I used to, as I said, my grandparents lived in West Jerusalem, which we lost in 1948. They moved into the West Bank, which is Ramallah. So my wife was English. We used to drive from, get a cab from Jericho in Jordan into Jerusalem. And after the, you know, you've passed and it's all just bare land and it's mountains and where it is. And as time went by, all what you see is settlements. Settlements. Everywhere you go is settlements. And, I mean, now nobody talks about the West Bank, nobody talks about Gaza. And living in the West Bank, I have relatives, they're so scared because there is no law. And if the settlers come in there to start attacking and taking people out of their homes, the police, is there, the Israeli army standing there protecting them. This is what I'm talking about, giving rewards to the moderate people. You're not giving moderate. Two-state solutions should have taken place a long time ago by force, by forcing the Israelis and by forcing the Palestinians. This is what is going to happen.
I know.
But the EU and the USA, unfortunately, they're very strong unless it comes dealing with Israel.
Sam is in Cambridge. I sometimes think about those negotiations which got so close to the line, didn't they, in 2000, the tail end of the Clinton administration at Camp David, in the end came to nothing. But where we might be now, who knows, if they'd come to something. Max is in Lyon, in central France. Max, good morning or good afternoon, where you are.
Hi, Lewis, how are you?
Very well, thank you. What do you have to say about this?
I called in to kind of give an opposing viewpoint, which is to say I don't think you're being entirely fair in how you're representing the facts in the Middle East as it relates to both Israel and Iran.
Go on.
And the way I see it is that, you know, to take an opposing view to your previous call, and also I'd say that the biggest cause of the conflict in the Middle East is religious extremism or religious, ideology.
Mm.
And that's what causes, I mean, when you look at what's going on between Pakistan and Afghanistan as well, and between, you know, the Gulf states with amongst themselves, Iran didn't just attack the United States, they attacked a bunch of other places too. There's a lot of problems. It's a very complicated issue.
Of course.
And so what I would just say is that I think that whereas, you know, maybe the execution of the plan was butchered, and I would have to agree with that. I don't think that Trump was very good at planning the operation. I think his instinct was good in that it needed to happen. And, sir, with respect, I've yet to hear an Iranian on your radio station, because I do listen quite often. I've yet to hear an Iranian call in to call in support or to reflect anything that you said. They always talk how much they are glad that Trump came and tried to do something, even if he didn't do a very good job. So, and then likewise with the Israelis, you always hear them speaking up in favor of what's going on, because they also understand that you can't just let somebody who wants your death to get stronger and stronger right next door. You have to act while they're in, and that's what's happening with Hezbollah.
But isn't the truth, I mean, we can all agree that the perhaps the aim was right, but that the effect as being precisely the opposite to what was intended. Let's just take Iran for the time being, which is that there's no doubt that Iran is going into this fresh set of negotiations in a stronger position than it was before the start.
No, I totally disagree with you. Well, and on a whole number of issues, sir, but your person from Iran called in and told you you were wrong about that as well. The truth is that
so
just from the military hardware, how much have they lost? You can talk about the Strait of Hormuz and being able to toll, and I have to agree with you. That was something that was always a risk and that people knew about for generations, and you're right about that. But that doesn't mean that they're stronger now than they were.
Well, look, proof of the pudding, Max, isn't it, is that the terms that Iran has put forward, the 10 points that they've put forward, which they say are the basis of the negotiations, are the maximal version, more than what they wanted and were negotiating for before the war started. And Trump has said that these are the basis for the negotiations, and he's happy for it to be the basis. So the very fact that that is the case shows that they are in the driving seat to a greater extent than they were when the negotiations were taking place before the war began.
Respectfully, I disagree. Well, I will agree with you that it was butchered. I'm not telling you that Trump did a good job, so I don't want you to...
But can I just come back to that? But it wasn't butchered, really, was it? Because the military execution of it... I haven't seen many people criticize the military execution of it.
No, I'm not criticizing the military, sir. I love our military.
Yeah.
No, I'm calling to criticize the fact that there was no strategic over you
right.
yourself, and I've listened to your radio station. You talk about how one day the goal was this, one day the goal was that.
Yes, right, I see. I understand. Right, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I'm referring to. And my point is that, yes, sir, it was totally poorly executed, and as a result, that's why it failed, because we have no plan. Mm. There is no success. But that being said, that doesn't mean it wasn't something that the Iranian people are grateful for and that wish would have been done better.
But I suppose...
With respect, when you talk about how Iran comes out stronger on the other side, I think you're omitting a lot of very objective facts, and you sound more like the Iranian mouthpiece than you do someone...
Oh, that's complete. That's absolutely complete nonsense, Max, and I reject that absolutely resolutely. I have, as repeatedly said, one of the reasons I'm irritated about this war, why I think it's such a tragedy, is precisely because... the Iranian regime is so appalling. But the objective fact of the matter is now, that as a result of their demonstration over the chokehold of the Strait of Hormuz, of the fact that the negotiating points that they've asked for are more than they were asking for in the negotiations before the war started, shows that they are stronger. And whatever happens now, I mean, look, if there had been, you could say, okay, it was a gamble. You could say... Trump thought and hoped that the Iranians would rise up, that the regime was, you know, basically built on sand, and that it would be gone by now. But then that gamble has failed, hasn't it? And the net result is that Iran is in a stronger position than it would have been. And like I say, you can say that was a gamble worth trying, but you can't, as far as I'm concerned, deny the results. And acknowledging that does not make you an Iranian mouthpiece.
No, sir, I agree with you. No, I was just trying to be proactive. I didn't mean to.
Heaven forbid on this radio station, Max. We don't like provocation.
I'm only joking.
I'm
American, so to me, that was you know, I meant more so to say that I agree with you. It was a gamble that maybe didn't pay off, and there's a lot of things that we don't know, and a lot of things that are yet to be revealed.
That's true.
And just because what they're demanding, that doesn't mean that that's what they're going to get. I would also say that they're not historically very, you know, clean as far as negotiating.
If they were in that weaker position, I mean, Trump's position has been that they were begging for a ceasefire. If they were begging for a ceasefire, and if the bombing had their desired effect, which was to make them put them into an extremely frail and fragile position, then they wouldn't be the next day blowing up the ceasefire by pointing to what's going on in Lebanon. The very fact that they've decided that the ceasefire isn't extant as a result of what's happening in Lebanon shows us that they're in a reasonably strong position, doesn't it?
No, sir. With respect, I think that what they're doing is they're capitalizing on and people like you, and I don't mean that in a negative way, who are more than willing to, and I understand your distaste for Trump, but who are willing to look at things a little bit less objectively because you'd like for it to tarnish Trump's reputation more so than you would like to acknowledge a victory or any success that might have come out of it.
All right,
and
Max.
I don't mean that in any mean way. I just think that it's making you irrational, your distaste for Trump.
All right, Max, grateful to you. Complete nonsense, by the way. I praise Trump before, when he's done things well. Actually, when he brought Netanyahu to heel around the question of the Gaza ceasefire, I said he's done something that Joe Biden was never willing or was never able to do. So although I absolutely have distaste for Trump's politics, not least the way that he talks about death and destruction, and frankly, who could have any other reaction given the insouciance in which he talks about basically genocide and the destruction of the Iranian civilization, then for sure. But ultimately, what we can see from this conflict, what we can see is that this quickly slipped out of his control. He had no plan. He had no theory for change. He didn't know what he wanted to achieve. He unleashed the dogs of war onto one of the most combustible regions in the Middle East and has then seemed surprised when it's blown up in his face. And that's not about disliking Trump or liking Trump, because we can see that plenty of Trump allies, some of his closest allies in the past, are making exactly the same point. So don't take it from me. Take it from them. Your thoughts on all of this, 0345-6060-973. News headlines at 11:33 with Dominic Ellis.
Sir Keir Starmer says he's discussed the logistics of moving vessels through the Strait of Hormuz during a phone call with President Trump. The Prime Minister says a coalition of countries are now working together towards a plan to resume shipping in the region. A 40-year-old man convicted of killing his wife after she took her own life has been jailed for 8 years. Kimberly Milne died in Dundee in 2023 after suffering 18 months of domestic abuse by her husband, Lee Milne. And BAFTA has apologised unreservedly to the black and disabled communities after a racial slur was broadcast during its film awards in February. The independent arts charity says a review found a number of structural weaknesses in its planning for the event. LBC weather turning increasingly cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK. Rain will move in from the west by the afternoon, a high of 14 degrees.
LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. GlobalAcademy.com.
Daniel liked how easy it was to transfer his old pensions to PensionBee.
I've had quite an eclectic career, and with that I'd amassed pensions from a couple of different providers. I signed up using the app. It was really straightforward. I was able to give them a couple of key facts about each of my pensions, and then PensionBee did the rest of the work for me.
At PensionBee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to PensionBee.com. And be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £91 million. It'll have you dancing like nobody's watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in tonight's draw. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. It could be you. Estimated jackpot. Rules apply. 18 plus.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrisons to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh value of a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26 Morrisons. Also sell other products. See online for more details.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK. So we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 11:36. We're going to return to your calls on this question of what Israel's end game is and whether until then world stability is beholden to Benjamin Netanyahu and his desire to stay out of prison. Well, hey, 0345-6060-973. Wanted to draw your attention to another piece of potentially apocalyptic news. Might be time to turn over to Classic FM. And this is around Anthropic. And you might be aware of Anthropic. It's one of the big AI companies. They're working on a new a new model of AI, Claude Mythos. Sounds like a Greek prime minister, doesn't it? I'm writing to, and this has drawn the attention of lots of politicians, including Danny Kruger, who is, of course, a Reform MP, who has written to the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, saying, I'm writing to draw your attention to the AI company Anthropic's recent announcement that their new frontier model, Claude Mythos Preview, is sufficiently advanced in coding capabilities to surpass all but the most skilled humans at finding and exploiting software vulnerabilities. The consequences of this announcement are extremely serious. This model has already discovered thousands of high-severity vulnerabilities, including some in every major operating system and web browser. This means that cybersecurity risks faced by British citizens and businesses are set to increase dramatically. As Anthropic announced in their acknowledged in their announcement, we should expect that these capabilities will soon proliferate, potentially beyond actors who are committing to deploying them safely, i.e. it might be time to turn on two-step authentication. Let's turn to Will Guyot, who's LBC's technology correspondent. Will, this got a little bit of attention online yesterday. I suspect not quite as much attention as it should, given wider events. But it's potentially very serious, isn't it?
Yeah, just to give you one explanation of this, Lewis, one of the things it discovered was a vulnerability that's 27 years old, so not been discovered in the 27 years since this particular piece of software was coded, that could effectively take networks, servers, firewalls, all kinds of parts of the essential infrastructure of keeping the internet and businesses running offline if it had been discovered and exploited by somebody else. So there's an element of truth in saying that this is really powerful. The whole idea of Anthropic banning it in quotation marks themselves because it's so powerful, there's probably some sales spin in that.
Will, but let's just go back just for a second, just in case and people are a bit lost, my fault as well probably, but just to say, what is this Mythos and what is the idea behind it?
So Mythos is a bit like what you would use at home for ChatGPT. It's what's called a large language model, and this is one of the dozens and dozens of different versions of these AI models that are being built. And this particular one from Anthropic is focused specifically on security issues. So if you like, it's the expert on online security and internet security issues. And it plays nicely into Anthropic's hands when OpenAI are attempting to boost their valuation and go public and all sorts of other things, to find themselves in a situation where they've arguably jumped in front of OpenAI, who are seen as the market leader, with something that can uncover all of these errors in the routine stuff that we use every day. And the challenge with this, Lewis, is these errors and holes exist in every piece of software and hardware and anything that we use with technology in it. But the trouble we find with that particular thing is that it takes other people to find ways of exploiting it. And the numbers don't lie. It has discovered thousands of examples of flaws on really critical pieces of kit that would cause untold problems if these got into the hands of the wrong people. And who are the wrong people, I hear you ask? Because you've got a question where we're all sort of saying, oh, watch out for Russia and these big boats cruising around, you know, in the Channel or in the Atlantic cutting internet cables. But arguably, if this technology developed by a US-based AI company leaked into the wrong hands, it could be actually far more harmful. And there's no oversight or visibility of what these companies are doing and the decisions that they're making. This isn't just a thing that's going to worry a handful of internet security and cybersecurity companies who've seen their share price tank on the basis of rooms of fine, intelligent people being superseded by a piece of AI, but it's the risks that come from it, the bigger risks to society.
So practically speaking, what could actually happen to your average person, or indeed your average system for a company or government? What vulnerability in the wrong hands, as you say, could be exploited, and what effect might that have?
Anything, any level of impact. Because what this is essentially doing, in the same way as I currently ask ChatGPT to generate me a photograph of Nick Ferrari on horseback, I could literally go to this particular system and say, find me vulnerabilities in the Google Chrome browser. And it would go and literally go and find any new exploits or problems, or given time, it could go through the software, go through line by line.
It would be that simple. All it requires is a prompt.
I'm simplifying it very slightly, but the reality is you set it upon other people's code and it does its job. It is designed to find the vulnerabilities. And a vulnerability could be something that hasn't even been considered. But the one going back to where we started, where I said about this issue, there was a piece of software called OpenBSD. And OpenBSD is an secure Linux operating system that runs on Unix operating system that runs on tons of big corporate government networks and all of those kinds of things. If something like that is able to be shut off through one of these vulnerabilities, you have untold levels of problems. It's not just food arriving on time because, you know, a supermarket's been hacked like we've had previously. It could be water systems. It could be anything. And that's I want to level it slightly and say, this is just one of the risks that we're facing from AI. And at the same time, different company, but same situation. We've had the expose about OpenAI this week from Ronan, can't remember his surname at the moment, in the US. The New Yorker have done this big expose on Sam Altman. And people say he's a pathological liar. He can't be trusted. And in the interviews that they've done to talk about this whole investigation, it's been considered that deceiving people and lying and being like really cutthroat in business is being seen by investors as the way to be ahead in artificial intelligence. Are those the people we want making decisions about what's safe and what's not in our lives?
And I think this is a key point, and it goes slightly beyond just this latest development, which is clearly important, Will. But I mean, I made a piece for the News Agents podcast, a long documentary episode last August, went to one of the big AI conferences, AI4 in Las Vegas, trying to look at this sort of politically, because obviously we get lost slightly in the technology. And for me, this is the thing, this is the sort of dog that never barks with this story, which is this is a huge political story. It's not a tech story, it's a political story, right? In the sense that what is happening right now, and I went to Anthropic, and I went to their headquarters in San Francisco, and I spoke to one of the most senior executives, and they themselves were saying at that time, probably a bit of PR with it, but nonetheless, they themselves were saying, look, we need to wake up because this is all happening, as you've already alluded to, basically beyond government's comprehension and beyond regulatory reach, right? The developments are happening so fast, so quickly, that governments, the asymmetry of knowledge between these companies who are just doing their own thing and governments who don't really have a clue what they're doing is vast. It's like the whole industrial revolution happening in kind of 10 years and the government's just going, what's all that about? And this is obviously going to affect everything everywhere very quickly. And it seems to me right now that one of the biggest political stories of our time is that this is happening and politicians and regulators don't even begin to conceive it or conceptualize it, let alone properly regulate it.
I think you've nailed that. The brakes are off as well. There's no regulation here. And like we're looking at this, for example, at the top end of this and the fact that this could cause real cybersecurity issues. There's the real fact that hacks and scams of people like my dad, who's in his 70s, are more effective now because people are able to use AI tools to create more convincing spam emails. So we're in this situation where we're all being told to move into this technology. The boss of OpenAI is even telling companies to consider shifting staff to 4 days a week to get ready for the AI revolution, and no government anywhere in the world is saying, hang on a minute, you haven't discussed this with us. We're all trying to get back the money truck up to the door and get more involvement from AI companies in our countries. And there is really clear evidence now, and I can happily say it, that some of these people at the top of these companies, if you go on the investigations by some fine journalists, they're not to be trusted.
Yes.
And we're letting them through the door.
I always say it's a bit like if the Manhattan Project, of course, being the project which developed nuclear weapons under FDR and then Harry Truman, if that had just been sort of directed by and allowed to happen by Ford or General Motors or Chrysler or whoever it was, and the government at the time not really having a clue about it, that's where we'd end up. We'd have companies being in control of nuclear weapons rather than states. But that's kind of the way that we're heading, isn't it? Because we're in a situation now where these companies, as I say, are largely self-directing, and they are directing their own kind of their own programs and so on, and they're competing with each other all of the time. And most of the time, politicians who don't really understand what's going on, all they can really come out with is kind of bromides about this is going to be great for the economy and so on. What do you say though to some people when we reported on this last summer? I had quite a lot of people say to me, "Well, look, you're falling for their spin. They're trying to keep. There's obviously been this huge amount of money and potentially a bubble that has developed in terms of artificial AI investment." investment, you know, literally like hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars going into these companies. They've got to kind of keep their own hype going. What do you say to that, that actually it's exaggerated, that there will be benefits and there will be changes, but we ought not to believe these companies, who you yourself have said are often quite mendacious?
Yeah, they are overhyping themselves. And a decade ago, we did a phone-in on LBC where we had an expert from the US come on and say universal basic income will exist by 2030. And we practically got laughed off the air 10 years ago. But things have moved on incredibly quickly. And we're trusting, Lewis, companies, a really good example, OpenAI, have forced up the price of all computer components in the world by 40 to 50% on the basis of orders they cannot fulfill. It's like me and you getting 100 quid from the boss to go out for lunch and me coming back with a claim for 900 quid and expecting the boss to pay it. I'd probably get sacked.
That's usually that's a normal afternoon on a Wednesday for John Sopel.
Yeah, it probably is. But for I guess the point is nobody is putting the brakes on them. Money is piling into these companies. I nearly used the phrase they couldn't organise something in a brewery, but I don't want to get sacked. But these companies are being trusted with all of this money and power and responsibility, and they haven't earned any of it.
Do you think, Will, that in terms of just people, I've seen a few people sort of texting in, if this is going to happen in terms of, and it is inevitable that these systems get rolled out, and, you know, the big, obviously, horror for AI, and there is obviously a really positive potential outcome for AI, you know, these systems could be used potentially, and they already are developing new drugs, new technologies, all sorts of different things. But obviously, in the wrong hands, that same system that could develop, I don't know, a new antibiotic, which has happened, or a new cancer drug, could also develop a biogenic weapon, or, you know, a new biological weapon, or virus, whatever it is. Just in terms of this internet security, assuming it were to get into the wrong hands, is there anything any of us can do?
No, simply because
really?
these problems happen before we're made aware of them. We can only fix them when companies release patches. It's what's known as a zero-day problem, as in a hacker finds out about it before a company does, and it's a constant cat and mouse battle. AI isn't all bad, though. My missus has just got through a very rare type of breast cancer. Since she's had it, AI detection levels, thanks to new tests and mechanisms, are really improving the chance of survival from this kind of breast cancer. So there's a lot of things to be excited about in the world of AI. But we don't have anybody in government that has a Scooby-Doo about how it all works. And they're all rushing it in and trying to get investments into countries, not thinking about what happens to jobs, what happens to our data, what happens to everything in a completely connected AI world.
Will Guyatt there, LBC's tech correspondent. Just interestingly, in terms of the political impact on all of this, Steve Bannon, who is obviously a checkered figure in lots of ways, but is a pretty astute reader of political runes in some ways, already talking about the possibility and likelihood of AI-related job losses being a big part of the 2028 presidential election campaign. They're already happening. Do go back onto YouTube or the News Agents podcast feed as well if you want to listen to that special report we did from Las Vegas last year. It's just called Will the AI Revolution End Politics as We Know It? Will the AI Revolution End Politics as We Know It? Special report from the News Agents. Trying not to look at this as a technological or even economic issue, but as a political issue, which it is. Continue this conversation with your calls on Israel and its endgame after this. The time is 11:50.
This is LBC.
Tony, what do you want to tell me? Good morning.
Scott has called from Glasgow. Hi, Scott.
Jane's in Camden first. Hi, Jane.
Households will benefit from £150 off of their energy bills with a price cap, giving households certainty on their bills until July.
Hear every side of the story.
You feel like asking what you have a luxury now to keep your house. Pharma is going to have to get involved.
I'm at the petrol station and it's just cost me nearly £100 to fill up half.
I'm almost in my 40s and I haven't ever had a break in war. Or in any of these living costs.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. LBC, leading Britain's conversation.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for Business. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrison to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh five a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl.
more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26 Morrison. Also sell other products. See online for more details.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato,
whoa,
and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify, pasta sauces with serious flavour. Dolmio, yeah.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Any tips for the game?
If it's games you want, your best bet is to check out BetVictor's casino games. They've got more games than you've had hot dinners. In fact, they've got more games than Las Vegas Gaming Convention's annual convention of games.
Lots of games. Got it.
Yep, there's over 4,000 slot games, including all your favourites like Big Bass Bonanza, live casino tables like roulette and blackjack, and casino games like Crazy Time.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on BetVictor Casino. 18+ gamblerware.org.
3, 2, 1, 0% APR on all electric Mini Cooper. What was that, Luton? Handling is extraordinary. Centre of gravity so low. And it could be ours with a 15% deposit and 3-year term. Okay, Luton, reroute me to the nearest Mini retailer now.
Land a new all-electric Mini Cooper with 0% APR. Report to your Mini retailer today. Mini UK is a credit broker. Ordered and delivered by 30th of June. PCP finance with Mini Financial Services. Subject to status. 18+. T's and C's apply. Mini.co.uk/Cooper.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £91 million. It'll have you dancing like nobody's watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in tonight's draw. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. It could be you.
Estimated jackpot. Rules apply. 18+.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:53. Zakia is in Colindale in North London. Zakia, good morning.
Morning, Lewis. My point of view that someone has to stop Israel for what it's doing. For me, as like I'm not from Lebanon, but my husband, he is Lebanese, and I know my family a lot. They have nothing to do with Hezbollah, nothing. But because they are in the border with Israel, it's very difficult for them to have, you know, a peace. Like, you know, after the ceasefire that happened last year, the drone every day comes inside the house through the window. It films everything inside the house and it goes, that's every day. So there is like no, you know, no security. They can't change their clothes normally until they have to close everything, and they can't move as well. If they move, they send them messages that, oh, you probably are doing something dodgy. And, you know, they're controlling people on the border. And they can't live like that. So I, for me, like I said, I don't support Hezbollah. I don't like the Iranian regime. You know, we just want to live normal. But Israel, by doing this for the whole year, I think it pushes Hezbollah to fight back again.
I suppose the thing is, Zakir, is that, I mean, you know, Hezbollah was partly created as a result of war in the 1980s that Israel was prosecuting. And so obviously this is, it's gone on for, you know, 40 years. And the thing that I can never understand is why there is a failure to understand that they cannot, and these forces cannot be defeated militarily. These sorts of insurgencies very seldom are.
You know, like I said, if they leave, the people leave on peace. They just, you know, leave them alone. You don't have to, you know, to record them every day. They had nothing to do with any political party. Like, we lost as well my husband's brother and his family, and he's a shepherd. He has nothing to do with the politics. He hates politics. But because he refused to leave his sheep alone, he'd been bought. His baby, she's 6 months, his son, he's 18, him and his wife. So just killing anyone in their way, they don't care. They don't care if you are related, you know, if you are doing something dodgy with Hezbollah or not. You just kill anyone they wanted. And that is so sad. Well, okay, you want to fight Hezbollah, fight it, find it. They have their own, you know, like...
Well, to be fair, Zaki, the Israelis say that because Hezbollah do what Hamas does, which is concentrate themselves in densely populated civilian areas, which means that it is unavoidable that there are civilian casualties in order to neutralise them to deal with their security threat. That's their argument.
Oh, no, that's not true. Believe me. You know, when they bombed Beirut, you know, 2 days before, there were no one, you know, like from Hezbollah. They just start pulling anyone in their way. They don't care. They don't care. They have no humanity. I'm not talking about the Jewish people. I came from a country. We have a lot of Jewish. We love them. We care about them. Our Jewish, it's like, you know, it's part of us. But, in, you know, in what Netanyahu is doing, he doesn't have any humanity in him. He's not. And I don't know. And I heard one lady, Sarah, she was calling before, and she was giving her opinion. And she said, we have to clear all the Muslims or something, you know, around Hezbollah. You can't just, you know, kill anyone around it because they have supporters, and there are no supporters of Hezbollah. She just wanted, like, everyone around that region to be, you know, killed, and
well, Zaki,
so they can have a peace.
Zaki, grateful to you. I'm not sure that is what Sarah was saying. I think what she was saying is that Israel had a security problem that it is obliged to deal with. I don't think she used those words, but I do hear what you're saying in terms of the dehumanization which has taken place in the Middle East and in parts of Israeli politics, because we see that on a daily basis. Ali is in Brixton. Ali, good morning.
Hello, Liz. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Not at all.
You're asking about Israel's end game. Please understand, I've never been to Palestine and I've never been to Iran or Iraq. So I have no first-hand knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got some thoughts.
Okay.
I also want to say that politicians and power mongers cause wars, not people.
Correct, yes.
And it's the people who suffer.
Yes.
And I don't care what nationality they are, but go back to Israel's endgame. This didn't start on October 7th, which, granted, was a horrific incident. It started in 1948 with the Nakba.
This is what Palestinians call the catastrophe. It's the foundation of Israel and the forced displacement of many people, many Palestinians.
After that, there was 1956, the Suez War. 1967, the Six-Day War with Lebanon. Gaza has been increasingly Palestinians in Gaza have been increasingly put into smaller and smaller and smaller areas. The violence in the West Bank, the displacement, it has been one thing after another, after another, after another. If you go back, way back, to the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a chap called Theodor Herzl. He was pretty much the founder of Zionism. He outlined Greater Israel. And it included Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Iraq, Saudi, all of those areas from Turkey down to Iraq, through Iraq.
Ali, I'm going to have to go in a second. So if you have 10 seconds just to sum up, because I've got to go to the news, if you come to your climax, if you wouldn't mind.
It's time people started putting sanctions on the states and Israel.
All right.
Because bombs are not going to do it.
Ali, okay. I'm grateful to you. Should say, of course, the plan for Greater Israel. I mean, it is something that lots of Israelis themselves do not support or agree with. It is contentious within Israel, and it is always important to point that out. I'm sort of reminded at the end of these 2 hours of discussions about what's going on in Israel, that Bertrand Russell quote, which is that war does not determine who is right, only who is left. We're going to move on now and talk. We've been talking about what is Israel up to. We've got a slightly different question now, which is what is Melania Trump up to? We're basically a one-trick pony on this show on a Friday, aren't we? Let's just rinse and repeat. What is Melania Trump up to? Going to the White House, calling reporters and telling them all that she had nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein when nobody thought that she did in the first place.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
For Tom Global's newsroom. Sir Keir Starmer says he's discussed the logistics of moving vessels through the Strait of Hormuz during a call with President Trump. The Prime Minister says a coalition of countries are now working towards a plan to resume shipping in the region. Peace talks between Iran and the United States are planned to take place in Pakistan tomorrow. Speaking following a meeting with Gulf allies in Qatar, Sir Keir Starmer told reporters the truce remains fragile.
More work is needed, that the Strait of Hormuz has to be part of the solution, a very strong sense that there can't be tolling or restrictions on that navigation. And so we come away from here with a real desire on their part to work more closely with us on defence resilience, on economic resilience.
A man convicted of killing his abused wife after she took her own life has been jailed for 8 years. It's thought to be the first case of its kind in Scotland. Kimberly Milne, who was 28, died in Dundee in 2023 after suffering 18 months of abuse by her husband. Lee Milne, who's 40, was found guilty of culpable homicide at Glasgow High Court last month. A teenage boy has been seriously injured following a dog attack in Wiltshire. LBC's West of England reporter Thea Rickard has more details.
Police tell us they were called at around 9:30 yesterday evening and they received the report that a 14-year-old boy had been attacked by two dogs which had escaped from their home in Riley's near Devizes in Wiltshire. We're told officers from various units went to the scene and the two dogs were seized. We're hearing they've been taken to secure kennels and their breed is still being established.
BAFTA has apologised unreservedly to black and disability communities after a racial slur was broadcast during its film awards in February. It also says an independent review has found a number of structural weaknesses in its planning for the event. And the EU's new border control process, known as the entry-exit system, is due to become fully operational today. People from outside the passport-free Schengen area will now have to register information like fingerprints and facial scans to cross the border. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 were trading up 37 points at 10,641. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather, cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK. Rain will move in from the west by the late afternoon. A high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do is...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's
my
house.
My tip
weight
is...
loss?
I
know,
forget
oh,
that, you just have to...
keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
I swear.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:04. Award of the day for the most, correct exit of the day goes to Andrew, who says, Lewis, you're not Howard Stern. Well, you're absolutely spot on about that, Andrew. I'm not Howard Stern. I'm not Leo Tolstoy. I'm not Oprah. I'm not even James O'Brien, who you'll be relieved to learn, will be back in this chair on Monday. That's absolutely true. Also, we've got another text here saying, oh, Lewis, please do the Melania voice. Do this next item in the Melania voice. I would not do that. That would be very rude. We are asking, what is Melania Trump up to? Having asked what Israel is up to. Because there was an extraordinary event yesterday which seemed to take even the Washington press corps by surprise, where Melania Trump, the First Lady, who seldom speaks in public, summoned reporters, certainly about political matters, summoned reporters to the White House on Thursday afternoon to give a surprise statement, which got them all worried and thinking, is it going to be about her health? Is she announcing some, heaven forfend, difficult to imagine this, problem in the Trump marriage? But no, it ended up actually being about Jeffrey Epstein, saying that she had no relationship with him, was not a victim of his, and had no knowledge of his crimes. In remarks that lasted just under 6 minutes, she said she wanted to clear my good name, addressing rumours that were not being commonly spread about the origin story of how she met her husband, the president, and she called on Congress to give a hearing to victims of Mr. Epstein's crimes. Well, let's listen to an extract of what she's told reporters yesterday. This is her denying those links to Jeffrey Epstein in that surprise statement yesterday afternoon.
I am not Epstein's victim. Epstein
did not introduce me to Donald Trump. I met my husband by chance at a New York City party in 1998. This initial encounter with my husband is documented in detail in my book, Melania. The first time I crossed paths with Epstein was in the year 2000 at an event Donald and I attended together. At the time, I had never met Epstein and had no knowledge of his criminal undertakings. Numerous fake images and statements about Epstein and me have been circulating on social media for years now. Be cautious about what you believe. These images and stories are completely false. I'm not a witness or a name witness in connection with any of Epstein's crimes. My name has never appeared in court documents, depositions, victim statements, or FBI in interviews surrounding the Epstein matter. I have never had any knowledge of Epstein's abuse of his victims. I was never involved in any capacity. I was not a participant, was never on Epstein's plane, and never visited his private island. I have never been legally accused or convinced of a crime in connection with Epstein's sex trafficking, abuse of minors, and other repulsive behavior. The false smears about me from mean-spirited and politically motivated individuals and entities looking to cause damage to my good name, to gain financially and climb politically, must stop.
Well, the First Lady went on to call for congressional hearings for survivors of Epstein.
I call on Congress to provide the women who have been victimized by Epstein with a public hearing specifically centered around the survivors. Give these victims their opportunity to testify under oath in front of Congress with the power of sworn testimony. Each and every woman should have her day to tell her story in public if she wishes.
So this got the political antenna of the Beltway Press Corps twitching, because the Trump administration and congressional Republicans have been extremely keen and eager to move on from the Epstein story and the DOJ files, and have said that such testimony and such hearings were not necessary. In fact, Donald Trump, her husband, has told the country it's time to move on, whilst at the same time, his wife striking a very different tone. As you heard, every woman should have her day to tell her story in public if she wishes. She had left the press conference with reporters shouting after her, "Why now, First Lady? Why now?" So this is the question I want to put to you. Why now? Why now? What is the First Lady Melania Trump up to, making this statement without any obvious provocation, without any obvious need or motive, at a moment when this story was not being talked about, let alone her relation to it? 0345-6060973, 0345-6060973. We were looking for someone insightful to turn to talk about this topic, but we weren't able to find anyone. So John Sopel, co-host of one of the hosts, the sort of third host of the News Agents podcast, currently in Washington, D.C., joins us now. John, what is she up to?
Good morning, Lewis. Good afternoon. Do you really want me to be on this call, or do you want me just to hang up after that introduction?
Well... up to you, really.
I tell you what, you know, the kind of obvious joke that was I heard being played out last night in D.C. was that, you know, Donald Trump started a war with Iran to get rid of Epstein off the front pages. And the war in Iran has gone so bloody badly that he now has told Melania to go and resurrect the Epstein story, because that's a lot better than for him than Iran. I mean, OK, that's a, you know, a silly kind of joke to have about what it is. I don't know. I mean, no one saw any of that coming. One of the best sourced journalists in Washington, Maggie Haberman for the New York Times, has apparently got a new book coming out. Hoon, she's taken a lot of time off the New York Times. She talks to everyone in the Trump administration. Was there going to be some nugget of information in there about Epstein that had caused alarm in kind of her circles, in the first lady's circles? And, you know, this was not her own words. You could tell that by the she kept on getting kind of mispronouncing things. And we all do that. But, you know, she kept on staying convicted. I've not been convinced of anything. And so, you know, it was written for her by lawyers. I don't know what the rumours are. I don't know what they've heard in terms of some, you know, is there some salacious story going to appear in a book or something else coming up that has resulted in her doing this?
What's certainly true, though, to say, isn't it, John, is that there seems to be some dispute as to whether Donald Trump himself was aware that this was going to happen. The White House initially briefing that he was, but then Trump himself sort of seeming to indicate later in the day that it wasn't. And it is certainly true that this is cutting against the trend of what the White House has been trying to do for some months, because they've been trying to say, right, that's it, draw a line, you've seen all the files, nothing to do with Donald Trump, it's definitely to do with Bill Clinton and so on, but that's done now, let's move on. And none other than the First Lady herself has reignited interest.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm sure he'll be furious about that, because there is no, you know, look, he's just fired his Attorney General, Pam Bondi, over her handling of the Epstein files, i.e., you know, why is this still? Because, and in fact, Pam Bondi was, for the most part, trying to protect Donald Trump from the Epstein files, initially kind of being very cute about what was being released, even though a congressional law had been passed that everything to do with the Epstein files should be made public. So Pam Bondi's had to walk the plank over this. Donald Trump has got increasingly furious about questions relating to Epstein and saying people should move on. And, you know, he was been appallingly rude to people. But this has history. I mean, Melania Trump in the first term at various times did things that looked like they were absolutely calculated to put distance between herself and the president. When he first had that policy on the border of, you know, children being separated from their parents, illegal undocumented aliens had come into the country, she went down to visit them and kind of wore a jacket with a, you know, something emblazoned on the back, you know, about giving a damn. And it was seemed like that was aimed at her husband. There have been other occasions where, you know, when it emerged that he'd, you know, alleged to have an affair with Stormy Daniels, she turns up in a pantsuit at the White House and Congress, rather, that looked very similar to the sort of things that Hillary Clinton wore. And it was, you know, so over the time that we've seen Melania in public life, there have been those occasions where she has wanted to show she's her own woman. She's going to demonstrate that, even if it's uncomfortable for her husband.
And it is an absolute gift, isn't it, to congressional Democrats who have been urging and saying that Congress should hear in live televised hearings from Epstein's victims. Again, something that congressional Republicans have said, no, we don't need to do that, it's all on a record in any case. But now they've got the First Lady of the United States herself saying that should happen. And every woman, she said, every woman should have her day to tell her story in public.
Exactly. Completely. And this, you know, is so uncomfortable. I mean, I've been really struck by the past week that we haven't heard a word from the Republican leader of the Senate, a guy called John Thune, nor the Republican leader of the House, Mike Johnson, over, you know, Donald Trump's sort of genocidal messages that I'm going to destroy a civilization will die tonight, never to come back again. You know, they have been, you know, you can be sure their opinions were sought on those things, and they've run for the hills, and you can imagine them running for the hills again now. Because, you know, what do they say? Do they say Melania's right and Donald Trump's wrong? Or do they say that Donald Trump is right and Melania is wrong? And that is the uncomfortable position politically that they now find themselves in. And I think that you could start to see now maybe that there will be these congressional hearings taking place. Because it is egregious that these women's voices are not being heard, given the scale of the allegations that have been made in the Epstein files. And suddenly you've got the First Lady First Lady leaning into this?
One extra question, John. This is for the news agents fans. Matthew says, any updates from John on the BA cabin crew or any Washington garden centres that you might have made an excursion to?
The really depressing thing about the BA cabin crew was the fact that this woman came up to me and said, I really love Lewis Goodall.
Well, I should imagine that happens to you a lot. John Sopalair, co-host of the News Agents podcast, currently in Washington, D.C. He's got some other good co-hosts as well, as a matter of fact. One in particular. Want to ask you what you think about all of this. What is Melania Trump up to? She has directly, effectively contradicted her own husband, the president, in calling for these congressional inquiries. And she's made a statement saying that she had nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein when no one was especially accusing her of having anything to do with Jeffrey Epstein. What is going on at the White House? 0345-6060-973. 0345-6060-973. 1217.
LBC.
Okay, this kitchen table office situation isn't working anymore. My home office needs to feel less making do and more CEO of my own corner.
Sounds like a job for Wayfair.
Exactly. A proper desk to spread out on, a comfy ergonomic chair, and a stylish lamp that makes video calls a little brighter.
With furniture and decor for every style and budget, Wayfair turns your home dreams into reality. So why wait to create the home you really love? Get it out of your head and into your home. Download the Wayfair app.
Need anything from Tesco? Like a pack of kettle chips? Now £1.65. Down from £2.65.
Club card accepted.
Because every little helps. Majority of larger stores, selected flavours, 130 grams, ends 27th of April. Club card or app required.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know your furry friends get up to all kinds of mischief. Like when the dog scuffed that entire chocolate cake. All the time the cat tested his 9 lives from the curtain rail. Again. That's why we're here when it matters most, with fuss-free pet insurance policies, including unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
Time is 12:18. We should say again that Melania Trump has said, you know, that she didn't really know Epstein, she had not been a victim of Epstein. She said that their connection, so far as it's there, is only that they briefly crossed paths in 2000. She also denied knowing Ghislaine Maxwell, the disgraced financier's jailed associate, of course. She referred to a 2002 email that has been in the files between her and Maxwell, released in the files, as I say, calling it nothing more than a casual correspondence and a polite reply. An email that appears to be the one she referenced is addressed to G, presumably for Ghislaine, and includes compliments about a story featuring J.E. with a photo of Ghislaine that appeared in New York magazine. She wrote that she cannot wait to go to Palm Beach. Give me a call when you're back in New York, the email says. Have a great time. Love, Melania. The New York Magazine article included quotes from the now president Trump calling Epstein a terrific guy and saying he's a lot of fun to be with. We should say, of course, that being in the files is no implication of any wrongdoing. What is Melania Trump up to in making this unprovoked statement? 0345-6060973. Arbid is in Wolverhampton. Arbid, your thoughts?
Good afternoon, Lewis.
Good afternoon.
My thought is that she's trying to throw him under the bus. And my reason for that is that she seems to be more... When you see them on TV or out in public, she seems to be more and more repulsed by him. She doesn't want to hold his hand. She doesn't want to be in his orbit, particularly, I don't think. And if she really does... If she really is innocent and she doesn't know Epstein, but she knows that her husband has been up to no good, I think this would be an ideal opportunity for her to, I don't know, just get her revenge. Because there have been rumours that Trump has been fooling about with an intern in the White House.
Well, I mean,
those are just rumours.
There are always rumours. There are always rumours, aren't there, Abid? So we've got no proof. No,
but
exactly.
If there's any truth in it, then she is a woman scorned. And as everybody knows, tell, have no fury like a woman scorned.
But it's weird, though, isn't it? But that's, I mean, I know there's obviously been almost anybody in public life, obviously Trump as well included, there were rumours about them, and there are rumours about Epstein connections, and obviously there have been people going through the files hurriedly and so on. So I know there had been some vague chatter and mutter about Melania Trump and how they met and Epstein and all that sort of stuff, but it was very low level, is my understanding. So why make this statement out of nowhere? That's the curious thing, isn't it?
But as I say, I think she's genuinely repulsed by him, and she just wants to get out of that particular toxic relationship.
But why then wouldn't she just leave him? She could do that if she wanted.
Wouldn't she want to cause him as much damage as possible?
No, I don't know. I mean, she's been with him a long time now. She's got a child with him. I mean, you know, there's no particular sign of any of that. Why would we conclude that? And maybe instead it's something about who knows? Maybe it's about the natures of the rumours themselves. She found it so abhorrent. But she hasn't responded to anything else. That's the weird thing.
So perhaps she is innocent then. In that case, why put yourself in the firing line if you think you're going to get hit? So she obviously must believe what she's saying, and there's no smoking gun as regards to her and Epstein, but there is plenty to shoot her husband with, if you like.
Oh, well, unfortunate expression, but I understand what you mean, Arbid. I mean, in a way, it is a living embodiment, isn't it, of the Streisand effect. Streisand effect, of course, being the name, the expression for the phenomenon where in denying something or referring to it, even if you're accused of something, even if it's terrible, you end up generating far more attention to the fact than it ever would have done if you'd never referred to it in the first place.
Asking for the ladies, or the young girls as they were, to actually finally have their day the open and get the truth out there.
And they certainly deserve that. Albin, thank you so much. I mean, they certainly deserve that, although, of course, some of them, this call has not been met with universal praise, it has to be said. Some of the victims criticising the First Lady, some applauding her. Joe is in Golders Green in North London. Joe, good afternoon.
Hi, Lewis. Big fan of you. Very excited to speak to you.
Oh, bless you. Well, thank you.
Okay.
I mean, I'm no John Sopel, but I'll do my best.
You're no Emily Maitlis either. So that's
well, I don't know about that. Let's come back to that another time.
So I'm still on X. I'm mainly on there for the memes, but I'm sure you know it's turned into a real cesspit.
Correct.
And I saw either yesterday or the day before, I think 2 days ago, quite clearly some sort of deep fake, but it was a picture essentially of Melania in a compromising state along with Jeffrey Epstein. And I think it's as simple as she's seen something in the dark, murky corners of the internet, and it's got her panicked, because we know that Donald Trump sees things in those corners of the internet, the dogs and cats, people eating the dogs and cats.
Oh, yeah, he is so online. He is, I mean, I always think Donald Trump is the quintessential online boomer. He is so online, and that's how he gets all of his news.
Totally. And I think it's just as simple as that. But that in itself is quite worrying.
Yes.
That the First Lady is existing in those spaces and amplifying the things that she sees on there.
But surely, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that I'm inclined to believe that explanation. And as you say, if that's true, it is kind of really weird and odd, right? Because it just sort of shows, I mean, Trump and the Trumps have long been both a kind of like manifestation of, but part of the kind of like meme culture in a way. Like I always say, you know, you don't get Trump without X. You don't get Trump without that kind of particular type of social media culture. He's both an embodiment of it and he pushes it forward at the same time. But the thing is that's weird about that, right, is to think, well, surely Melania, if she's so plugged in to those kind of like online pictures and spaces, surely she's seen loads of other stuff about herself over the months and the years. So why this?
Hard to say.
Maybe it's because Epstein is so toxic, maybe. Maybe it's just so bad. Maybe it bothers her more than
maybe,
other things.
Maybe, but I think it probably also speaks to a lack of communication between the two of them. And she's sort of gone out on her own and is, in her own words, seeking to protect her quote-unquote good name.
But she's got good... I mean, you know, she has got proper... You know, she's got her own press secretary. It's not like being the Prime Minister's wife or husband, spouse, you know, in this country where you basically just sort of tag along and you expect to defend for yourself. You know, First Lady is a proper office. She's got her own offices in the White House. You know, she's got her own massive staff. She's got a press secretary. They would know that by doing this... They would have the Streisand effect. They would draw attention to something that wasn't really being talked about. So why would they do that?
Who knows?
Who knows? Well, that's not good enough, Joe. I'm asking you if you know. I'm asking all of you as well. Joe, grateful to you. Do you know? 0345. Hey, if the First Lady is up, as John Sopel is in Washington, maybe just gone for a little walk along the Potomac, put LBC on. Oh, James O'Brien's not there. This guy, Lewis Goodall, don't like him. You can just phone in, First Lady. Feel free. We'd love to hear from you for all your analysis. Eleanor is in Camden. Eleanor.
Hello. I have a feeling that a bombshell news is going to happen. I have a feeling that Ivana Melania was significantly involved with Epstein, and she wanted to come in first and tell her side so that she can, because regarding the news that is about to come, she wanted to put her opinion first.
I mean, we should just say, she has been extremely clear that she did not have any relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, the First Lady.
But I have a feeling that's why she made this speech, because there's a photo where the four of them are together, Trump, Epstein, and Ghislaine, and Amalia, and that photo, they're all happy there, and she was a lot younger, and I have a feeling that she...
But it could just be a photograph. I mean, you know, photos are taken, aren't they? But in those sort of parties, New York parties, photos are taken. She doesn't mean she knew him.
I have a feeling that she was involved with Epstein way before she met Trump, and Trump, where there's money, he makes friends where there's money, so Epstein had money, so...
I mean, it would certainly, I mean, it would be, I mean, it's got to be a theory, right? A theory has got to be that she is aware of some upcoming story or revelation or whatever it happens to be, that maybe it's not what you've described, but there's something Epstein adjacent in the Trump world, and I don't know, like she's trying to get ahead of it. I mean, that would certainly make sense. Although, from the commentary that I'm reading out of New York and Washington this morning, this afternoon, there doesn't seem to be any expectation of that in particular. So, who knows?
I feel she's involved. I think that she's significantly involved in what's about to come out. So she just wanted to put her opinion first before.
Or could it be something more banal, Eleanor? Could it not be, as we were just hearing there from Joe and Golders Green, could it be more banal that the First Lady is just like her husband, extremely online, extremely exposed to kind of the darker corners and fringe conspiracy theories at parts of the internet, dominated by MAGA, for whom that is their sort of exactly the seas in which they swim on a constant basis. And she's seen something, and she's seen it multiple times, and she sort of had enough. She snapped, as anybody who's been subject to speculation or attacks online knows, that it's just awful, and that this is something that she's had enough of. Whatever reason she's focused on this in particular, I don't know, but that maybe it's an evidence of just something more banal, as I say, that she's just a very online woman.
Well, she's just married to the so-called most important man in the world. But
yes.
She knows what's going on. You know, obviously she's married to the president. So, you know, I think she got to a point where to protect herself, she had to make this speech, because it significantly... involves her. That's what I think, anyway.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Eleanor. So he's certainly a view, and I can understand the appeal of that kind of, there must be something that's about to come out, and there's something behind it, and there may well be, who knows? And there may well be, and then all of this will make sense. I am still, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, tell me why I'm wrong, 0345 6060 973, I'm inclined still to believe this Joe theory, which is that we are dealing with, in the First Lady and Trump, I mean, we're certainly dealing with Trump, with the most online president who's ever been, which is sort of kind of a bit weird and ironic, given he's also the oldest president, or there will be the oldest president that there's ever been. Although he absolutely embodies something that I think is absolutely the heart of our politics, and actually a lot of the destabilisation of our politics, and I know some of you will get offended by this, but it is the online radicalised boomer who gets a lot more. We constantly talk about young people and being too online. Honestly, I think there's a bigger problem sometimes with older cohorts who are very online, who don't have the, as I would put it, the digital hygiene with regards to news that very often younger people do, because they've grown up with it, and often they can see and detect and smell stuff that isn't right. that they see online, whereas older people don't always have that, and it comes a bit less naturally. And I think Trump is the prime example of that, who is both a symptom of the radicalization online of older people and a driver of it. And I suspect that the First Lady is very much in that orbit and is quite similar and is plugged into a lot of quite extreme fringe online stuff. And she keeps seeing it and she keeps seeing it. She's on her phone all the time and she keeps seeing it and she's had enough. And she's happens to be a person who is very online, who also has access to the entirety of the world's microphones whenever she so pleases. And I suspect that's what she did yesterday. Tell me if you think I'm wrong. 03456060973. We're going to be thinking about the effect on all of this, as we always should, on the victims. That is coming up. News headlines first, 12:31 with Tim Humphrey.
Sir Keir Starmer's been discussing logistics with leaders in the Middle East as nations prepare for peace talks tomorrow. Delegations from the US and Iran are due to meet in Pakistan days after a two-week ceasefire was agreed. A violent domestic abuser has been jailed for 8 years in a landmark Scottish case after his wife took her own life. Lee Mill was found legally responsible for the death of 28-year-old Kimberly. US military planes and helicopters are on standby to meet the four astronauts who will splash down in the Pacific overnight after travelling around the moon. They will hit the Earth's atmosphere at 32 times the speed of sound. LBC weather turning increasingly cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK. Rain moving in from the west during the afternoon and a high of 14 degrees.
LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Okay, this kitchen table office situation isn't working anymore. My home office needs to feel less making do and more CEO of my own corner.
Sounds like a job for Wayfair.
Exactly. A proper desk to spread out on, a comfy ergonomic chair, and a stylish lamp that makes video calls a little brighter.
With furniture and decor for every style and budget, Wayfair turns your home dreams into reality. So why wait to create the home you really love? Get it out of your head and into your home. Download the Wayfair app.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park. The fun goes on and on and on and on. Book now at nutcatch.com.
Oopla.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
Time is 12:34. We're talking about that extraordinary, impromptu, out-of-nowhere statement that the First Lady Melania Trump made yesterday about her relationship, or as she would say, her non-existent relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Among other things, she called on Congress to allow women who wanted to, victims of Epstein, to be able to testify before Congress, something that congressional Republicans have been resisting. She has been accused, now this has not been greeted with universal acclaim though, but from the victims of and survivors of Epstein, who in a joint statement, some of them to the media, a group of survivors, said the First Lady had moved to protect those in power. They accused her of shifting the burden onto survivors under politicized conditions to protect those with power. Survivors of Jeffrey Epstein, they say, have already shown extraordinary courage by coming forward. Asking more of them to do so now is the deflection of responsibility, not justice. It diverts attention from the former Attorney General, about whom we were hearing from John Sopel, Pam Bondi, who must answer for the withheld DOJ files and the exposure of survivors' identities. Those failures continue to put lives at risk while shielding enablers. Survivors have done their part. Now it's time for those in power to do theirs. I should say, some victims have welcomed what the First Lady, or survivors, welcome what the First Lady has said. But powerful words there from a group that have released that statement. Let's talk now to Jamie Shrive, Director at Victim Focus, Doctor Researcher in Politics and Criminal Justice at King's College London. Jamie, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. What do you make of what that group of survivors have said? Do you think that that will be a majority view insofar as it's possible to tell?
I think that it probably is going to be a majority view, not just across survivors, but across most people who have any interest in politics. You know, we've seen in the UK, abroad, you know, in the US, the way that survivors, victims of sexual abuse, victims of domestic abuse, will be almost wheeled in whenever it suits governments, political actors, politicians, and sort of use them as a trophy or to almost suggest that they are competent on an issue of salience. That's something that we see quite a lot within political science, is the way that political actors will what's called ride the wave. So at the moment, violence against women and girls, child sexual abuse, child sexual exploitation is quite a big issue in the public, and rightly so. But it's not particularly a surprise to me that when things are starting to get difficult for the Trump administration, that once again we see survivors wheeled in, used perhaps as a tool to distract from the unfavourable position that the administration has taken. And again, for them to be called upon to do even more once again, when in the past, you know, they've spoken, they've given their testimonies and nothing's changed.
So do you think that this, because it does seem extraordinary and to some inexplicable, you think that this may be an attempt by the Trump administration itself to deflect from the criticisms that have been made, particularly of Pam Bondi, the former Attorney General, how she handled the DOJ files and so on? But doesn't it just generate more interest in that?
There is definitely the potential that could be the case. But also, I think what we have to do is we have to look at the patterns internationally. If we were to look at this from a lens from the UK, you know, we have already seen the levels of particularly the right wing and the far right, where they will capitalise on victims of sexual abuse and they will use it to push their own agenda. We've had it with the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse and exploitation. You know, we already had an independent inquiry pushed in 2020 and it was published and no actions were taken by the previous government. And yet what we've had over here is, again, during a time of political instability, the far right have again started suggesting we need another inquiry, we need another inquiry. And finally, we've had another inquiry that is going to go ahead. And to what end? Because all we see as survivors and within this sector is victims are being asked to do more, to, you know, almost open their wounds more and more, and nothing ever happens. We don't see law changes. We don't see increases in prosecution, and we don't see increases in conviction or decreases in abuse itself.
I think that is such a vital point, Jamie. I mean, I've long thought this. I think, and you know, in the media, we can be guilty of this as well, which is that I think sometimes there is an almost, how can I put it, almost vampiric, it feels sometimes, kind of like sort of rush and desire to sort of put this stuff out there. And you can say some of it comes from a positive place, which is to say, okay, we need to recognize people's testimonies. It needs to be heard. People need to be heard. They need to have their day. That's the language that the First Lady used. And I can understand that. But sometimes it feels almost as if it is just kind of, It's just that is sort of displacement activity from actually looking at the substantive stuff. And that if you allow people to come forward, tell their stories, and we pat them on the back and say, that must have been absolutely awful for you, that's enough in itself. And at worst, you can almost say it almost becomes almost a form of entertainment, doesn't it? And that is really, really grim to think about.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, you're right to explain the importance of the way the media will platform those voices, but there comes a level of where this becomes entertainment. You know, so many of our true crime documentaries, for example, the vast majority is just male violence against women. And very often within that there will be levels of sexual violence and in some cases child sexual abuse, and it's really, really important that whilst we do continue to platform these issues, we have to also keep the heat on the politicians and the political actors who are, you know, capitalising on them to make sure that there is political will to actually change these issues. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we have. You know, if you ask any professional within the violence against women and girls sector what they think needs changing, we could probably all give you a very, very good answer. And we've been able to give you those very good answers for, you know, decades now. But unfortunately, the reality is it doesn't actually transfer into legislation changes that are meaningful or changes in stats.
I mean, and that's and a perfect embodiment of that, just to take the American example, isn't it, is that, you know, the First Lady could get her wish and we could have some of Epstein survivors come before Congress and put their testimony on the record. And of course, that's symbolically important and that record would be there forevermore. They've obviously, those who'd be willing to speak about it have spoken about it elsewhere, but I could see the sort of the symbolism of that being important. But ultimately, they could be as powerful and as they could possibly be, and their stories could be as heart-rending as they could possibly be, and they could be as emotive as they could possibly be, and it still wouldn't make a difference to the politicians sat around that committee to do what they want them to do, which is to have an inquiry into how it was that so many of their names have been published entirely and properly at the same time that some of the potential abusers' names have been redacted from the files, but also to actually publish the remaining files that Pam Bondi and others have refused to do. So it would entirely be basically performative.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And at worst, what you touched upon there is severe re-traumatisation of victims where there's no wraparound support for them. And then what level of protection is there for those victims? And then the questions of, OK, so why now when there has been such high levels of previous inaction? We've already had the world looking to America and to the US and to the Trump administration to publish these files in full and to bring, you know, the many, many perpetrators to justice. I think it is important that we do validate sort of Melania's points around her being held to such a high standard when so many other actual perpetrators are not.
Yes.
But regardless, the timing and her call for victims again, I think is at best, you know, sort of a bit tone deaf, and at worst is another attempt to try and appear competent in the face of such international unpopularity.
I mean, the truth is, isn't it, is that, and this is what makes me, just finally, Jeremy, what makes me really uncomfortable about so much of this and the sort of performative element that we sort of insist that so many of these women come forward and bare their souls in public, and then we all are shocked by it and we all go, that's absolutely appalling, is that, let's look at the substance. You could argue in the UK we have had, or at least the start, potentially, of some legal redress in terms of some of the accusations, although the sort of wider effect, I think, is still relatively unaddressed. In the United States, there has literally been nothing. I mean, there has been nothing that has arisen from the Epstein files other than, basically, a series of highly partisan attacks in each different direction. And actually, to be honest, there being an incentive for every party and all of the political players to dismiss it and try and move on as soon as possible. Because the truth is that the people that named in those files, not that being named in them implies guilt, but the people for whom perhaps there are at least some questions to answer, there is no partisan label to that. It's Democrat, Republican, everything, and everyone's got an excuse to move on. So the truth is that all they're really willing to do is ask these women to perform. And what is the point of that?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. And that's why political will is at the crux of this, is that we know what these issues are. We know how to solve them. We've solved, you know, other violence and abuse issues to an effect that is greater than what we've solved child sexual abuse and sexual violence in general. And there is, you know, very little to nothing in the way of political will over in the States. Now, we do have a higher level of that in the UK. And I think because of the new Labour government passing so many pieces of legislation that they published in their manifesto around making Vogue such a prominent issue and claiming to halve it within 10 years means that there is more pressure and there is more political will from inside our government. And that's why we have seen things like Mandelson being sacked and things like that. But the other question is, are we going to go far enough? and what barriers are going to be put in place? Because as you said, there are so many perpetrators potentially named in the Epstein files who are part of, let's say, the Democrat or the Republican Party. We know that perpetrators are very common in our society, every single layer. So it's likely that statistically, purely on the balance of probability, there are probably going to be abusers within any government, our government included. And so there's always going to be a level of, I suppose, pushback when it comes to dealing with issues of abuse.
Jamie Shriver there, a director at Victim Focus, doctoral researcher in politics and criminal justice at King's College London. I do think that that point about the us as a society, media as well, political sort of society, insisting that women bearing their souls in that way, survivors bear their souls, as if that is sort of enough in itself, as if it's sort of getting off your chest and that being enough. If that is all it is, then it is an absolute disgrace and an outrage. And without it's if women want to do that, survivors want to do that, that is of course up to them, and they should be encouraged to do so and given avenues and platforms to do so, but only if there's surely some political effect at the end of it. Otherwise, all it is, as I say, is a form of particularly grisly entertainment, which is pretty grim. What is Melania Trump up to? 0345 6060 973. Time is just turned 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Pressure ramps up on Israel to stop its bombing in Lebanon. Does anything justify it continuing? Are we serious enough about our defence? And what in the name of America is Melania up to?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Looking for a new kitchen that you can't wait to come home to? Wix has over 80 kitchen styles, from ultra-modern to timeless classics. And options for every budget, with kitchens for first homes and forever homes too. So book your free kitchen design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1, or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday, and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus, UK only, no purchase necessary.
Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrisons to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh five a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26. Morrisons also sell other products. See online for more details.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
Time is 12:50. We should say an important piece of context that this is probably relates to is, of course, that you may be aware of the journalist Michael Wolff, who has written lots of books on Trump. There is a sort of bizarre lawsuit and counter-lawsuit that is going on at the moment because, and I should say again, you know, Melania Trump has denied all of this, but Wolff has claimed that Epstein told him that Epstein introduced Melania Trump to Donald Trump, and that directly contradicts Melania's long-standing account that she met Trump by chance at a party. And basically what's happened is that Melania's lawyers apparently were threatening a defamation suit, and Wolff responded by suing her first. And so it looks like this is going to be resolved in the courts. And it basically boils down to that allegation. That may be part of it, and this denial, we just don't know. But that is certainly a bit of context. Ben is in Benidorm, sunny Benidorm. Ben.
It is very sunny. You're way ahead of me here, because I rang up with that very point. I think it's purely down to Wolf. Now, Wolf made a series of very lurid allegations, actually, against both the Trumps.
Yes.
He's done something extraordinary, which is most people either withdraw whatever they've said about the Trumps, or they settle, or they become utterly compliant in some way.
Yes.
He's actually countersued, and I think she's trying to get ahead of this stuff. To be honest with you, I have so little faith in both Michael Wolff as a journalist and the Trumps. Yeah.
Who do you believe? I mean, honestly.
who do you believe? You know,
good luck, courts.
I find Wolff quite odious, but on the other hand, I find the Trumps odious too. So very hard. Very, very hard.
So you think this is Melania trying to sort of get ahead of that legal process?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, there is a legal process, so I'm assuming it will go in front. I think she wants to be seen. Melania, at least sort of superficially, is considerably more sympathetic than Wolf, who always, I think, comes across appallingly kind of in the media and things. And I think she's trying to get ahead of it. I think that she's sort of... She's saying, if I can at least get some public opinion behind me and all the rest of it. I mean, Wolf is not a likable guy.
No. It's kind of like being asked to choose between food poisoning and norovirus, isn't it, really? Hard to say.
Brilliantly put, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Brilliantly put.
Ben, in Benidorm, grateful to you. I do think it's probably a key piece of context we should talk about. Steve is in Southampton. Steve.
Hi, Liz.
Afternoon. What's your view on this?
There's something I've never done. I've never murdered anybody.
Well, that's a relief.
But also,
because you should probably ring Crime Stoppers for that. You've got the wrong number. 999 if you have murdered anybody. Well, probably. Or just go down to your local police station.
But I've never called a press conference to say I haven't murdered anybody.
Ah, I see. No, that is true. If you did call a press conference, Steve, how many people do you think would turn up?
One.
Well, that's one. One more than most people.
But Trump dismissed Pam Bondi. She knows where the bodies are buried.
Just to remind people, Pam Bondi was Trump's attorney general. She had been in charge of the Department of Justice, and she was in charge of being forced to release the DOJ Epstein files. Yes, exactly. And she was supposed to release all of them, but some of them have been held back, and she's now been sacked by Trump. She's left the government.
Yes, but Trump has not said anything bad about her.
No.
Everybody else Trump has sacked, let's say, he's what's the word I'm looking for?
You're going to have to get better for your press conference, Steve.
He's disparaged their reputation. He hasn't with Pam. And this is why Melania's doing what she's doing.
Who would you be inclined... Would you believe the First Lady?
Would I believe a Trump? No.
Of the two Trumps, which would you be more likely to believe?
Barron.
Okay. You know what? I think I'd believe him least. Steve in Southampton there. Yeah, something about it. It's the hair. Can't be. It's also looks too much like young Trump. Way too much like young Trump. It's unsettling. Jane is in Bromley. Jane, good afternoon.
Hello. God, yeah, definitely don't trust Barron. My God.
I think he's the really dangerous one. We've got to keep an eye on Barron. Very close eye.
I think we should.
Very close eye on Barron. I'm worried about what Barron's up to at night.
Right now.
Go on, your view of this. What is Melania up to, Jane?
Okay, so I can only go by, or rather I am only going by, things I've read online.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Yep.
Siren emoji.
but I reckon it is on the money. So she's getting ahead of an interview being published in a Spanish paper, El País, or is it a
El
magazine?
País. El País. That's the main newspaper in Spain.
With Amanda, another survivor.
Right.
Amanda Ungaro.
Okay. Not familiar with this one.
Amanda Ungaro. What I've read is, so I can't swear, but something bleeping dark. The story is Amanda Agaro, so yeah, survivor and victim. Also recently, I say recent, I don't know when, but recent-ish, was arrested, deported by ICE to Brazil.
Right.
She's in a legal contest to get her son, who she shares with another member of the Trump administration.
Okay. But your point overall, Jane, without getting too bogged down in this case, I'm not familiar with her, so I don't want to get too into it without knowing the details, but your point is to say you think you subscribe to the theory that something is going to come out and that she's trying to get ahead of it.
100%. And I don't trust Melania at all. I trust none of them.
Not even Barron? What about Tiffany? Tiffany Trump? We never hear from Tiffany. She keeps a very low profile. What is Tiffany up to? If you've seen Tiffany recently, 03456060973. No, please don't. Christoph is in Wembley Park. Christoph.
Hi, Lewis. First of all, great to... you've been covering James O'Brien's spot. So it has been...
Who?
Lewis got
it. I don't remember.
James
Who?
O'Brien.
Who?
I remember the time you really got one over on James O'Brien once. I think it was to do with a discussion about Don Blaine or something, and you really got one over on James O'Brien. I remember that.
At that
point, I realised you had a great future.
Gosh, right. Okay. Well, I'm not sure why I would have been trying to get one over him on that subject, but anyway, what do you think about Melania?
I can't remember the... So, I don't think anyone has ever convincingly ruled out the idea that Donald Trump is a Russian asset.
Right.
So my sort of conspiracy-level theory...
I basically did invite the conspiracy hour this hour, didn't I? I should have known where we were going, but go on.
I just want to be serious for a second. I want to partially go back. I hate slightly contradicting a victim's, a victim's advocate, but if some survivors are... probably going to have to testify under oath in a court if some of these people are going to be brought to justice, and very few of them have actually named names, probably under the instruction of lawyers.
Yes.
So if they were to testify to Congress under oath, they would presumably be asked those questions.
Yes.
And so. I think there might be some value in it. That, can I just get that in? But look, I think that someone, probably Vladimir Putin, may now feel that their asset in Washington is no longer of any use to them. He's kind of done the maximum damage that he can.
What's the number one piece of evidence, Christoph, you think that Trump is a Russian asset rather than just a blundering fool?
Well, he spoke to... He sent him vaccines and stuff, right, during COVID, all right? You know, how about that?
Putin sent him vaccines?
No. Trump said... Don't you remember that Trump...
Operation Warp Speed?
No, yes. Probably following Operation Warp Speed. I think it's quite widely reported that Trump sent Vladimir Putin some vaccine.
Well, it's a nice Christmas present, isn't it, for Orthodox Christmas? Christoph, grateful to you. I think maybe of all of the bits of Trump-related conspiracy, Vaccine Gate wouldn't have been top of my list, but hey, I'm out of time. No more time to discuss it. James O'Brien, remember him? Can't quite recall. He'll be back on Monday, apparently, and if you missed any of today's show, you can, of course, listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. You can stay up to date with all the latest news, videos, and opinion. You can listen to a range of podcasts, including the News Agents, which I'm off to record right now because I'm just a canavite like that. Look it up, including Lewis Goodall as well, in for James O'Brien on the Lewis Goodall / James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from the LBC show every day. Been an absolute pleasure sitting in for James all this week. If you've liked what you've heard, then you'll very much enjoy Sunday with Lewis Goodall every week from 10 till 12. If you haven't liked what you've heard, you definitely will not like that show. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it is Tom Swarbrick, but now it is time for the greatest LBC host there's ever been, Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, Donald.
Who's that? That's Melania.
That's Melania.
Oh, Melania, you're looking beautiful.
Donald, what in the name of all that is holy... I'm getting to Camilla in a minute. What in the name of all that is holy possessed Melania to give that address from the White House, we are told, without Donald Trump's approval or knowledge? Was she doing a Diana, get me out of here, or a Camilla, I'm on the side of victims? Which was it? At two, in rather choice language, Emily Thornberry rather nailed the defence question, didn't she? We need more friggin' frigates, she said. But I'm going to start, I think, where you started as well, Lewis. Lebanon says it won't enter talks with Israel until Israel stops bombing the country. Donald Trump says he told Benjamin Netanyahu during a phone call to scale back what he was doing. Is it justified in any way, shape or form?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Keir Starmer says he discussed military capabilities and the logistics of moving vessels through the Strait of Hormuz when he spoke to Donald Trump last night. He says a coalition of countries are working towards a plan to get shipping moving again. Israel's been criticised for continuing to attack Lebanon, saying it's not part of the ceasefire agreed with Iran and the US. Lieutenant Colonel Sarit Zehavi is a former Israeli army intelligence officer. She told LBC Israel wants to stop Hezbollah from rebuilding power.
The basic assessment here is that we will be allowed to continue our maneuver in South Lebanon, at least to secure the people that are living here, like myself, from short-range missiles and from invasion or infiltration of Hezbollah terrorists to our community.
A man's been jailed for 8 years for causing his wife to take her own life. Kimberly Bruce died in Dundee in 2023. It's the first such case in Scottish legal history. In sentencing, Lady Drummond described Lee Milne's 18-month campaign of abuse.
The abuse was not only physical. You belittled her by shouting and swearing at her, calling her names. You tried to cut her off from her family, checked her phone, restricted her movements and controlled her access to money and transport.
Police patrols in London and Manchester are to be stepped up around synagogues and mosques. The Home Office is putting £5 million towards keeping worshippers safe. It follows attacks on four Jewish community ambulances last month and a synagogue in October. BAFTA says it's written to anyone affected by a racial slur shouted from an audience member on the night of its film awards to apologise. It says it should never have been aired in February, but it's also led to unfair judgment for people with Tourette's. The final details have been revealed for Queen Elizabeth II's memorial. Planning permission has been confirmed for a statue in St James's Park opposite Buckingham Palace. A statue of Prince Philip will accompany it. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 33 points at 10,639. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather turning increasingly cloudy and windy for large parts of the UK. Rain will move in from the west during the afternoon. A high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement? That's the weekly flutter. With chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly, over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. Now, the early days of a ceasefire, certainly one as serious and critical as this one, are rarely straightforward, rarely quiet, and that's certainly been true of this one, hasn't it, since the middle of the week. We have the Iran-US talks scheduled for tomorrow in Islamabad, see whether they happen at all, whether they get anywhere, and an offer from Israel to hold talks with Lebanon, for its part saying we will only speak to Israel once they've stopped bombing Beirut and any other parts of Lebanon. So that's where we are on what will or won't happen. I've been conscious in our conversation as well, our conversations plural, that it can so easily become, or perhaps I'm confusing our conversations on air with the experience I have on X and other social media, it can so easily become a shouting match. If you say even the slightest thing about why Israel might be doing what it's doing, talking about why somebody might be doing something isn't the same as approving what they're doing. that's lost a lot, I think, in conversations. So talking about why they might be doing what they're doing, I think, is a valid exercise. And I have my thoughts on why Benjamin Netanyahu might be doing what he's doing. Some of them are from his own selfish point of view, in my view. Some of them are from historic self-preservation, as in self-preservation of Israel, that point of view as well. And the same is true of the Lebanese. The same is true of the Iranians. It's a very, very complex picture rooted in deep and very vicious history when it comes to Iran anyway and Israel, and certainly when it comes to Hezbollah and Israel. So let's talk about what's going on. Sir Keir Starmer was talking earlier on the ceasefire while he's travelling in the Middle East.
Well, the overarching impression here is the importance, as they see it, as us standing with them as an ally, as a friend of theirs, at a point of need. And there's been reflection on the work we've done with them over the last 6 to 7 weeks on collective self-defence. Here in Qatar, we've got a joint squadron. So a real sense of here we are as an ally, standing with our allies when it matters most to them. Obviously, the discussion moved very quickly to the ceasefire. A sense that it's fragile, that more work is needed, that the Strait of Hormuz has to be part of the solution. A very strong sense that there can't be tolling or restrictions on that navigation. And so we come away from here with a real desire on their part to work more closely with us on defence resilience, on economic resilience. That's really important to us because this is impacting us back at home on our economy, so it's very important we do that together. It's a big opportunity as well for the United Kingdom. So it has been important that we've been here, and there's a sense here, as there is, I think, in the United Kingdom, that this conflict is going to define us for a generation, and we must respond, and we will respond with strength.
I thought that was interesting when he said this will define us for a generation. I don't think he's wrong. I'm joined by Jonathan El-Khoury, Christian Lebanese, who emigrated to Israel with his family back in 2000 because of the fear that Hezbollah would murder his family. He's also a lecturer on Israeli-Lebanese relations. Good afternoon to you, Jonathan. Thank you for joining me.
Good afternoon, Sheila. And I have to kind of agree with your remarks at the beginning, where we need to ask why Israel is engaging in Lebanon to begin with. And the simple question is, the simple answer is Hezbollah.
I agree with you that the simple answer is that. And the less simple answer is the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah and the grip it has had on Lebanon for so long, despite the Lebanese government mm-hmm. not wanting that grip.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. We've seen the Lebanese government trying to get rid of Hezbollah, or Hezbollah's weapon to begin with, for the last almost 2 years after they dragged Lebanon to another war that has nothing to do with any Lebanese cause. And you have to look at the history of what's happening here. A lot of people mention, oh, well, Hezbollah wasn't, created or wasn't still a terrorist organization when Israel started to engage in Lebanon back in the 70s. And then you need to go back and look for a history and look for the context of why Israel started to engage in south of Lebanon, and that was the PLO terrorist organization led by Yasser Arafat that occupied territories of south of Lebanon and started attacking not just Israel and Israeli communities like on the northern border of Israel, but also attacking Christians in south of Lebanon, Shia Muslims, and other fellow Lebanese citizens, where it led Israel to engage, like we're seeing today, to military go into Lebanese territories and push back the PLO northern from the Israeli border. That previous one was super successful, and hopefully this one as well.
And well, we've seen various iterations of that happen.